It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, and I have such a great panel for you. Tim Stevens from CNET, Christina Warren, Film Girl, is here from Mashable, and my buddy Alex Lindsay from PixelCorp. We're going to talk about the latest news, Apple's quarterly results, Crandroid, the merging of the Chrome OS and Android, and a report from the Tokyo Motor Show. Tim Stevens was there, and it's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT This Week in Tech, episode 534. Recorded Sunday, November 1st, 2015. Puffy little clouds. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost, automated investment service that is the most sophisticated way for you to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/TWiT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/TWiT. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToMeeting.com today. And by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one easy integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/TWiT. And by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter TWiT. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the latest tech news with Christina Warren from Mashable.com. And I see her Apple TV screensaver in the background. Isn't that the best screensaver ever?
It's the greatest ever. I know it's on our notes, but we'll talk about it. But I wanted it on my Mac. That was like the one thing I wanted in my review. And now that's available.
So yes. It's super exciting. I immediately installed it. Also with us, Alex Lindsay in the flesh.
I'm back.
He's been all over the place. Last I saw you, you were in Africa.
I was in Africa 2 weeks ago and India last week.
That's right. You got sick in India, though. I'm sorry.
Not from India. I just want to be fair to India. I had food there. I was totally fine.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Because I saw a picture of that meal you got for 50 cents. That looked like it could have been a culprit.
I was already recovering by the time I had that meal. Right. I had to take it turns out if you go from Africa to India, you need to have a yellow fever
Shot. Gotcha.
And then you have to, and if you show up at the airport and find out, you have 1 hour to find a doctor, figure out a way to get them to backdate it.
And
give you the shot. And it turns out every time.
Are there guys like just sitting on the curb ready to give you fever shots?
No, there was a guy, it was a race. It was quite an adrenaline adventure through Rwanda to figure that out. And then but then I get sick every time I have a yellow fever, shots.
I know how that is. I don't.
You need more than one? You like have to continue?
No, I lost the card. I lost the stupid yellow card.
Don't get more than one.
Well, I've had three now, so I'm never going to get yellow fever. That's the one thing I know. So
I shouldn't laugh.
I thought that I had missed it, but then I started getting sick, and then I knew I was toast.
Sorry.
But the India, the food itself was great, and I didn't get sick at all. But I'm pretty careful.
You and I have dined in Indian food in San Francisco. You're an expert.
I like my Indian food.
Yeah, I do too. Love it. Also here from Upper New York State, Tim Stevens CNET fame. Almost said
it's only been 2 years
word.
Now, Leo.
Yeah, I know. I'll learn. Welcome, Tim. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much. I like Indian food as well, by the way.
Who doesn't? Let's have Indian food for the show today.
Yes. Sure.
All right. So you got your Apple TV. I got my Apple TV. I've been playing with it. It does do that thing where you go, what did he say? And it skips back and puts the closed captions on.
I
love that.
So good.
I can't tell. Can you tell, Christina, what services It's searching cross-service search?
Yeah. So it does Hulu, Netflix, HBO Go or HBO Now, Showtime or Showtime Anytime, and iTunes. And
well, that's pretty good.
That it does now. And that's just to start. They're going to be opening up an API for it to be broader. And I mean, I'm not hoping that other services, you know, like Watch ABC, Watch ESPN, and some of those will join it too. But out of the box, I have to say, and that's one of the big things, because I have every device. The universal search is definitely the best out of the box, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, because Fire TV has it, but it only searches Amazon's own stuff.
It only does Amazon for the voice stuff. The new Fire TV 2, which I haven't had a chance to really review yet, we've got one, but I haven't had a chance to spend a lot of time with it, will search more services, but only from certain menus. So you can do voice search, you know, to find things, and it will show it to you on Hulu or not Hulu, on HBO or on Netflix. But if you're in one of those other apps, then you're SOL. You can't use voice search or search universally. So what I like about the Apple TV is that I can be literally in any app and I can say, show me, you know, Scandal, and it'll bring up Scandal everywhere. Or I can say, show me Tom Cruise movies on Netflix, even if I'm inside Hulu, and it will take me back out to that place. So to me, that makes it a better overall experience than like Roku's universal search is good. And TiVo's actually is really good. But you've got to go to a universal search main search page to actually access that. Whereas with the Apple TV, you know, you just talk into it or use the search function at the top and it'll go across all those places. My big hope is that when the Plex official client comes out, there's an unofficial client that works pretty well. When the official client comes out, that will coincide hopefully with some sort of you know, API for the Siri universal stuff, and then you could bring in your Plex results too. That would be really ideal, but we'll see.
Cross-platform search is in many ways the holy grail, but I gotta say, I mean, the Apple TV doesn't have Amazon.
No.
And I feel like that's a big hole in its offerings.
But don't it most is. TVs have Amazon?
Yeah, almost everything has Amazon, and nothing has Apple except iTunes except Apple.
Right.
So, but I prefer to buy stuff on Amazon or Google and Google Play, and neither of which are on the Apple TV.
The nice thing is you can use AirPlay from your iPhone or your iPad and connect that to the Apple TV and watch the stuff that way, which is kind of the workaround. It's weird, though, because I mean, I've spoken with a number of Amazon employees, and these are high-ranking people over the years, about the fact that, you know, Amazon wasn't on the Apple TV. And I know that they, even as recently as like a year ago, really wanted that to happen.
Yeah.
It's weird that now they're not there. And it seems to definitely be Amazon's choice because they could build an app. And not only are they not there, but they've pulled, you know, the Chromecast and the Apple TV from Amazon.com. So you can't even buy the competitors' products. And so there's a lot of questioning. And I don't know what the answer to this is, which would be if, let's say, Amazon did build an app for tvOS, which wouldn't be very hard. They could take their existing iPad app and make a couple of modifications and bring it over very easily. Would they be accepted in the App Store? And I don't know.
This, though, is the screensaver. And it's what it is photo, video, aerial video from all over the world, moving very slowly, but it's real. You could see the leaves blow in the trees and the water move. And it's stunning. It's just gorgeous. And now I'm running this not on my Apple TV, but as you mentioned, somebody has extracted all the screensavers.
How kind of them.
And made an Apple, a Macintosh screensaver. You can get, they put it up on the code up on GitHub.
Yeah.
Love this screensaver.
Are there any flying toasters on there?
No flying toasters. I have flying toasters on this machine, but not in this. I should turn off the time because that's annoying, isn't it? My issue with this is it's $200. It's an improvement. I think the talking to Siri is useful, especially the cross-site search. I think an app store is important. It's certainly important to us at Twit. There are not one, two, but three Twit apps already in the app store, which is pretty good since there are only a little more than 60 apps total. But I don't, you know, I played Rayman for a little bit last night, played Crossy Road. I bought a joystick or a game controller to go with it. And I just didn't feel like, I don't know if it's worth $200.
I don't know if it, I don't know about right now. I haven't gotten mine yet.
Yes.
It's coming.
Yeah.
But I think that when you look at the opportunity of all these iOS developers and, you know, most people have.
It's an ecosystem.
It's an ecosystem, and most people have benefited pretty dramatically over being first movers in the iOS right. environment. So I think we're going to see a pretty big explosion in app development for this platform, and not just for, I think, for entertainment. But I think that the Apple TV is, you already see a lot of these in schools, in corporations for a variety of other reasons. And that was before the apps were available. Yeah. So I think that there is a lot of markets beyond just the home that this is going to be very useful for.
I should point out $200 for the 64 gig version, $150 for the 32 gig.
But get the 64.
It strikes me that you'd be kind of nuts to get the 32. They say, Apple says, well, if you're just going to stream video, you're not going to download a lot of apps. No. You don't need 64. Don't but how do you know that, right?
How do you know? You exactly.
Don't,
know
that. Don't do that. Don't
it's
do
not
that.
Like you can upgrade it.
No, well, that's the thing, right? And it they don't make it that easy to manage your storage space. I mean, you can choose what apps you want to install and uninstall. And that's pretty easy. You can see what's taking up the most space, but you can't really manage how they do their caching for different stuff. And so right. Early on, a lot of people were concerned with the games. They were saying, oh, well, how are these games going to be able to show up on the Apple TV because they can't download stuff, you know, the way that we thought that we could. They're limited to a certain size, but that's only for the initial, I guess, like code side. You can then download assets in greater sizes. So if you download Crossy Road or Asphalt 8 or other games, you know, it'll take a little bit longer and download that stuff. And that takes up more space on your device, you know? So yeah, I tend to be one of those people who, whether it's from Apple or Google or Amazon or whoever, it's like I buy whatever the most space is, they'll let me buy.
I'm the same way. Although, you know, they have this app thinning idea that you don't have the whole app. You just have the stuff you absolutely need and then download and delete as needed. I still feel like, I don't know. I think Apple does this. They have a 16 gig version of the iPhone 2. They don't That's expect such, yes. you to buy it. They just want to be able to say it's only 150 or starts from 150 bucks.
I mean, I have to admit, if they had made a 128 gig version, I would have gotten that.
I know. Why not?
you know, you just put
What's
more
the
on
deal
it?
Though with 4K? We talked about that a lot. Apple says absolutely not. It will never be a 4K device. Doesn't seem to be any reason why it couldn't be hardware wise.
It's there's some chip issues.
I was going to say, I think there are some chip issues.
Yep.
Go on.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's the A8 chip that's in the iPhone 6. You can play back 4K video from that chip.
Yeah. Anyway, Christina may have
who knows?
More,
I mean,
more
you know,
detail
we don't
about
really
it.
Know.
I feel like if they did the A9, then they would be, which is what's in the 6 and the 6S and the 6S Plus, right? Are we on A9 now? I feel like then they probably would have been able to do 4K more easily. I think it's a chipset thing. I also think it's probably like, and you have to think, I mean, you get the distinct feeling that they would have liked to have maybe brought this out 6 months ago.
Right.
Because of just various things. I mean, feel like this was something that was ready to go maybe from a hardware perspective.
They wanted to make deals with the networks and the local stations. They weren't able to make those deals.
They weren't able to make
them. So they said, let's release it. We're going to have to release it. If you're going to be cynical, it also gives them something they can do next year
right.
with an updated Apple TV when there are more right. people with 4K displays.
Well, and when there's more 4K content. I mean, I honestly
there's a lot of 4K content. I don't know how good it is, but there's Vudu and there's Netflix. There's a lot of 4K content.
No, but have you ever actually looked at what content is available on Netflix? It's like six things. It's like Breaking Bad, which is actually 35mm converted to 4K where they do like the scanning process, right. Okay? Then you've got, House of Cards, the second season and the third season. There are a couple of movies that are 4K conversions and are, for their part, okay. There's a lot of nature films. I mean, still like HDTV.
That's
and, like,
how it was. Remember? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mark Cuban,
like
Bikini TV.
Yeah, I was going to say HDNet. It's like all of that stuff where it's just like
Sunrise
a lot of
TV.
Sun, yeah.
Yep.
By the way, have we mentioned the screensavers? Great screensaver on this thing. Have we mentioned that?
Stop plugging your show, Liam.
I would just sit and watch this all day. This might as well be 4K. Roku, what is it? 100 for the Roku 4, $129. You get 4K. You get everything except you don't get iTunes and you don't get AirPlay.
And you don't get the App Store that's going to have lots of these games.
We'll wait and see.
I think that's going to be a big
either.
Deal.
Roku gave up on games, you know. Roku started.
They did. They tried it.
And they thought we could. And then they said, you know, not to keep it at a good price point, to make a convenient small box, we're going to stick with streaming. And not worry about gaming.
Well, and I think it would have been hard for Roku to do it. I mean, I think that the difference is that there's already an enormous number of games that have been built.
You know, Android TV, I could play all those games on my Shield, my NVIDIA Shield, and watch 4K video. It's not very compelling. If you got a, if you care about gaming, you have an Xbox or PlayStation.
Right. This is more like a Wii, I feel like, even down to it, you know, the controller stuff. Yeah. Which is not a bad strategy, but I feel like gaming, at least, I think the gaming part is like a nice to have, but I feel like you buy this maybe for other types of apps that could eventually come out.
What do you think about Amazon, though, saying they pulled all listings for Google and Apple TV devices on Thursday? They're gone. They yanked them.
They're gone.
I think it makes Amazon look petty.
It makes you look petty.
They spent really all this time. Go ahead.
It's just a really bad precedent. You know, Amazon's obviously interested in moving into other areas and other market categories. And if they're going to pull up the competitors' products from every category that they move into, that's obviously a pretty bad thing. It's also interesting that they haven't pulled competitors' smartphones or tablets off of there, and even gaming platforms. You can see that being a competitor. It's really just a petty, ugly thing that Amazon's done. And I hope it's something that they don't continue to do for other companies.
They spent all this time trying to say, no, we're really not that company that was
written.
We weren't hacked. I mean, that was a hatchet job. We were, you know, we are really a nice company, and now we're going to do something that is really small-minded and petty.
Well, and then the excuse they give, which I find strains credulity, to say the least, is, oh, well, they don't have Amazon streaming apps on Chromecast and Apple TV, and we don't want to support that. Whose job is that, Amazon?
And it's because Amazon doesn't agree with the rules. Go ahead.
If they wanted to add it to their app, like, because they already have the AirPlay support, you know, for the Amazon apps on iOS, they would literally have to enter in one line of code, and then it would work on the Chromecast.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand the Apple TV argument a little bit. Maybe they're saying, we don't know if Apple will accept this. And
we'll try.
We don't know if Apple's going to build this. Fine. But with Chromecast, it's complete BS, because it would literally be like one line of code in the existing Amazon app. And keep in mind, Amazon opts not to offer their apps in the Google Play Store. Like, you've got to download them directly from Amazon, and that's fine. But Google has even told me, just because it's not in Google Play doesn't mean that it couldn't have the Cast API stuff. Like, that wouldn't matter at all. So it seems like, I mean, there's no way you can view this as any way other than, like Tim was saying, just a really petty move that has a really bad precedent.
Well, Google's made an open platform with Chromecast.
They have. And I mean, they developed the original APIs and the SDK stuff with Netflix. Like, it's, you know, the TiVo from a couple of years ago had it early on. You know, like, there are other companies who support this stuff. It would be very easy for them to support it if they wanted to. So I feel like that's like the worst excuse. If you don't want to support it, okay, I get that. If you don't want to carry your competitors' products, I don't love that, but fine. But don't try to pretend like you're the victim in all of this when actually you're not, you know, because...
it's also not even good business. I mean, the issue is, you got people who... The kind of people who are buying these right now are the kind of people that probably spend a lot of money on Amazon. I spend a lot of money on Amazon.
I spend tons of money on Amazon.
And one of the reasons that I spend a lot of money on Amazon is because I always know I can get everything at Amazon. I don't have to put my credit card stuff in again or my address. I just know that I can just go up and get it, and it'll be there in a day, and it's easy. And as soon as they make it hard, well, I'll go find it somewhere else, and then maybe I'll start ordering more stuff from somewhere else. You know, and it's just, it's just so boneheaded.
Did I mention, though, what a great set of screensavers?
Is that your point? Your point really is here. Is
now we're going over London.
That's great.
There's the London Eye. These, you know, I think these come from Apple announced a couple of years ago that they were, for Apple Maps, they were going to do flyovers on major cities in small planes to get great aerial views for their maps. And I have a feeling that's what
this is. Just the raw data. They're like, hey, we got all this stuff laying around. Yeah. Why don't we just throw it
up? What about
there?
That video we shot the other a couple of years ago?
Oh, and then they've got the nighttime shots. Those are great, that they come from time of day. The stuff in Hawaii is great. I mean,
it's time of day. So, like, it's sunset now. So I'm getting the sunset pictures. Oh, see.
Exactly.
Wow.
Oh, they're so great. They're
so really, you should just buy an Apple TV for the screensaver and forget it.
Or just download.
And leave your TV on all day long.
That's so good.
That's what gets me about screensavers in these set-top boxes. You don't want to leave your TV on all the time. What do you need?
Yeah, I have a 60-inch plasma that's cranking out. I don't know how much heat. I don't want that thing on.
You don't
want
to leave it on all the time.
It turns itself off after a couple of minutes.
And everybody, Roku has great similar, not this slow-mo video stuff, but they have similar shots. Chromecast has beautiful pictures, including my own images. Look at that, New York City. Oh, makes you want to go there, doesn't it?
It really, I live there, and I'm like, I wish that my life looked that good.
This is video because you see the boats. You have to look. It's for slow motion video, but you can see the boats moving ever so slightly, and the wakes ever so slightly. It's pretty cool. Slow-mo video.
The cars driving across the bridge. I mean, it's just really spectacular stuff.
I wonder if Apple's going to shut this guy down for doing this. I'm sure it's a total violation of copyright.
Oh, I'm sure it is. But it'd be weird because I wonder if they can. I mean, you know, because he's pulling directly from their servers. So maybe they change their server endpoints. But that's
easy to shut that down then. So these aren't. He didn't download these from the TV. He's accessing the server. Oh, get this screensaver while you can, because it's not going to work much longer.
Found out where the TV, where they're storing the stuff, and then people Xcode app that'll go into a screensaver. You can even select which ones on his little app, like which ones you want. Yeah, you can select which ones you want, which ones you don't want.
I can change the time of day.
Yeah, you can. They're really nice. They're about 500, you know, megabytes or 600 megabytes, I think, a piece. So they're not small video files, because they are video files. But my God, are they beautiful. And so...
I see.
I got them running on my TV, as well as on all of my computers. I downloaded the ones I want. I'm like, yep, this is. I want New York at night. I want New York during the day. Some of the San Francisco ones are really great. Some of the Hawaii ones just make me depressed because it's cold. We're starting to get cold.
Oh, look, China, day 1, 2, or 3. Hawaii, day and night. London, day and night. New York City. Oh, my golly. And you can even have... Oh, I got to set this up on my 3-monitor display at home. You can have a different aerial on each one. Oh,
there you go.
Oh, he's going to be out of business so fast. In fact, probably by the time you listen to this podcast. But it's github.com/John Coates with an ES at the end. Nice job, John. Good luck not working at Apple ever again. I'm just teasing. He looks like he's 12. At punk something. He's a punk.
He probably is like 18.
Yeah, look at him. He's a kid. He's a kid.
Great project. I mean, honestly.
What's nice is he came out with it like instantly. And he wrote it in Swift, so there you go. Nice. And you can also install it on other systems using Brewcast. All right. Very nicely done, John. Let's take a break. We're having fun. Lots to talk about. Christina Warren, film girl, is here joining us from his travels around the world. Mr. Alex Lindsay of Pixel Corps. And the car guy at CNET, Mr. You must be getting excited. Is the lake frozen yet?
It's getting cold up here. No ice just yet. But yeah, it's looking like it could be a good season for ice racing.
Tim Stevens, the ice racer. You got the car already?
No, I don't. I've been traveling way too much. Yeah, it's still up in the garage. I got to get to work on that.
Do you have to do stuff over, during the off season to like keep it in, you know, you don't put up a block, strain the crankcase, and just leave it?
No, I need to on this one, though, because I actually got run into in the last race last year and broke my suspension, and I haven't actually fixed that yet, so I need to get cracking on
that.
What
do you drive?
I race in a 2002 Subaru WRX.
Oh, nice. And no, he's not joking. He does ice racing. When the lake once the lake's frozen, he'll be out there.
I will.
Crazy.
You're all welcome to come see.
How thick is frozen?
12 inches or more is the minimum. They go out and they drill about 20 pilot holes across the lake to make sure that it's thick enough. But we'll have, you know, 40, 50 cars out racing at a time, plus trailers, plus tow trucks, plus spectators. There's a lot of people out there, so you got to make sure it's thick enough.
That's awesome.
We all want you to do it in a Tesla with ludicrous mode.
That would be amazing. If anyone from Tesla's watching and wants to hook me up, they might be a little worried about the dents and things that would result. But this is wheel racing.
It would be so worth it. And the videos they would get would be unreal.
And you choose the ice because of the great traction out there.
The lack thereof. Yes. Yes, absolutely. That's what makes it fun. You can go sideways at 80 miles an hour, and it's a grand old time.
You're insane. I love it. This looks like fun. This is the Subaru, right?
Yeah, that's me and the Subaru from, I think that's last season. Yeah, so that's the start of the race.
Look at this guy. He's already spinning out already. You don't get to use snow tires, right? Chains?
We use street legal tires exclusively. So they are DOT legal studs, which are very, very small, about 2 millimeters long. So they are studded, but very small studs.
So you get a little bit of traction.
A little bit of grip, yep.
Just and, enough to fool you into, you know, being a little overconfident.
Yeah, that's the main problem for a lot of people. And as the race goes on, the ice gets more polished from all the cars sliding, so the grip decreases a lot, actually. So the rookies usually spin out about halfway through the race, so I make up a lot of ground.
How much would it cost to put a big Twit logo on the front?
For you, I'll give you a good discount. We'll talk after the show.
I want a badge on your fire suit. Oh, wait, he's not wearing a fire suit.
I'll get one for you, too, Leo.
He's wearing corduroy.
I'll give you some money for the tire fund.
I love it. More coming up in just a bit. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront. There's a problem. You know, you got to save for the future, buying a house, you know, your rainy day fund, retirement. I know. That's so far off, you don't even want to think about it. It happens faster than you think. And you got to start saving now. The sooner you start saving, the better. The question is, as you save, how do you manage that? What do you invest in? What do you do with your money? Do you hire an advisor? You know, they're going to take between 1% and 3% every year of what you've got under management, not to mention hidden fees for transactions and changes. You'd have to do awfully well to overcome that. That's like starting a race with a millstone around your neck. Of course, you could do it yourself. That's what I always thought. I'll do it myself 5 years later. I wonder what's happening to my investments. I don't want to look, right? Yeah. I don't want to look. I got a great solution for you, Wealthfront. Wealthfront makes it easy for anyone to access world-class, long-term. I want to emphasize this. This is long-term investment management. You could start today at a minimum of $500. That's the open an account. And they're doing stuff that's really impressive, tax loss harvesting, direct indexing. It's all done in software, but the software is designed by some of the best investment advisors in the world, people like Burton Malkiel, who wrote the incredible Random Walk Down Wall Street, and Charles D. Ellis. These are guys who have really figured it out. They've written software they've got more than 200 years of investment experience on that team, and they've written software that capitalizes on all that in your best interest for your long term. And by the way, Wealthfront automatically rebalances, automatically invests your dividends. It's all commission free. So you're going to optimize for the best risk adjusted return net of taxes and fees. And it does all this for less than, remember I told you an advisor costs you 1% to 3% a year? Less than 0.25% a year. With no commissions, there's never any hidden fees, and it's completely transparent. You'll see what they're doing. You've got an app that you can see exactly what trades they're making on your behalf at all times. It's not a surprise. Wealthfront has grown 2,000% in the last 2 years, 20 times growth. They now have over $2.6 billion in management. It works. It's brilliant. It's exactly what you're looking for. And right now, if you go to wealthfront.com/twit, they'll manage your first $15,000 free of charge forever. So not a quarter of a percent a year, nothing. Forever, up to $15,000. Start with $500. It's so important you put this money aside. And do it smart so that you don't spend your time, you know, not managing your money or paying somebody an exorbitant amount of money to do it. I love these guys. Wealthfront.com/twit. For compliance purposes, I have to tell you, Wealthfront Incorporated is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there is the possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit Wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure. Tim Stevens, he's still. How cold is it? Cold in the car? Or do you have a heater?
I definitely have the heat on in the car, but it's always pretty chilly out in the lake. I think the coldest this winter was about 20 below. We were up in northern New York, and there's always, of course, a lot of wind coming off the lakes too. So
it does actually look really fun, doesn't it?
Yeah, it actually looks
really fun. I have to admit,
it's a ton of fun.
I would die quickly.
And it's $50 for all day racing. You get 3 20-minute races plus a 20-minute practice. That's as cheap as it gets in the world of wheelbarrow racing.
That is really fun. Look at that. Of course, you got to keep up your car.
That helps.
that's not an insignificant expense, I'm sure. All right, enough talking about ice racing. There's many other things to talk about in the world. Apple, according to everybody and their brothers, will be selling the iPad Pro come November 11th. That is 10 days off. And selling it, not just taking pre-orders, but apparently it will be in the stores. You're going to rush out and get one?
Yes.
I knew you would. I don't think I am. I'm having a hard time really justifying getting another iPad, even a giant one.
Like I haven't gotten one, and I have to say, I haven't gotten one for years. I mean, I haven't bought a new one since the three. I didn't buy the four.
Guess why Apple's doing this? Because no one has bought a new one in years. They got to give you a reason to get out there.
And I got like three or four of them floating around the house. One is almost shattered, and the other one, I guess, the version one, I think now only half the screen works. Yeah. So it's about time to get a new one.
I can't find my iPad Air 2, which is a problem.
Well, is it, though? I mean, isn't it kind of a signal that you don't really need it?
No, I do need it, and the battery died, and I can't find it because my house is a mess. And unfortunately, I didn't have the Find My iPhone feature turned on where it'll like show you its last location.
So you don't,
I don't know.
It wouldn't help. You would just know it's in your house. You'd know that.
But which would actually be helpful because I don't know if it's in my house or if it's at my office, which is also a mess.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where I'm like, but yeah, no. I don't think I'm going to get one off the bat just because I don't need one. But I definitely want to play with one.
Yeah, me too. I'm pretty excited by the prospect here. I'm just a little bummed out that it's as expensive as it is. You know, $300 more than an iPad Air to start seems like quite a premium. But I definitely think that there could be potential for big sales here. I keep reading surveys that show like 90% of tablets never leave the home. And if you're looking for the ultimate couch surfing device, you know, 12 inches is better than 8 or 9 inches or 5 inches. So I think it makes a lot of sense. But that... you know, that cost definitely pushes it up to the professional market, and I'm wondering how many pros are going to go out and dive on these things and start using it for sketching and design and that kind of thing. I'm curious to see the adoption there.
Well, you don't have to guess too much longer. I'm holding in my hand. Wait a minute. Don't show that Windows logo. Something very similar to an iPad Pro. This is the Surface Book, but a Surface Pro would be very similar with it. And, of course, Microsoft says... this isn't a pencil, it's a pen, and it has an eraser. So there you go. Take that, Apple. I have to say, this, of course, is not going to be like the pencil where you can do the edge and there's low latency, you know, zero latency. This has very little latency, but maybe it's a little late. I don't know. Does that look latent to you? It looks pretty fast to me.
I've just found that even with the Surface, I have a Surface 3, that even with that, I find it hard if I sit down. And this is what I'm interested to see what happens with the Pro, is that I want to be able to take notes on, you know, just like take notes on the screen and like when I'm at a location.
Look, I just press the pen button once and I'm taking notes.
And I just find that the text is still not as, like, and maybe the Pro won't be any better, but I just find that it's not, like, writing on paper yet.
Well, it's slippery, right? There's a little...
There's that. It's...
Yeah.
And when I'm drawing, like, little diagrams of, you know, I'm usually doing site surveys, and so I'm drawing diagrams of buildings and rooms and trying to do stuff. And it's close.
Yeah.
I take a lot of notes on my S Pen, on my Samsung Galaxy Note, which I've become hooked to. I've had the last three generations, and I use that constantly. So for that's a huge boon for me to be able to take notes on there and export them into Google Docs as a PDF and just pull them up on my laptop. That's fantastic. Samsung's done a lot of work to get the feel of that down. So, you know, it's still not the same as writing on paper, obviously, but it is still. It's pretty good. I'm definitely curious to see what the writing experience is like on the Pro. But even so, you know, taking notes on a 12-inch tablet, that actually seems like that's a little bit too big. In that case, because you know, you want to hold it in one hand and then write with the other hand.
Right.
If you're not sitting, that'd be a little bit too much. Right. For me, the note is the perfect size for that. I can hold it easily in one hand and scribble with the other hand. And I do scribble my handwriting.
I have a Note 5, and I really like. I have to say, the pen is very well done on that.
I rarely use it.
I rarely, right. And this is a Surface Book, and I rarely detach this. You know, the only thing it's actually a little bit good for is crossword puzzles. You can do Sunday.
That's a good idea.
This is a nice Sunday Times crossword puzzle device. And you can hand write, but it will do the recognition in there. Let me just load a puzzle that I've been this is it. I like touch. I wish Apple put touch on the MacBook. I really like touch.
I do
a lot.
Too.
Yeah, this is just such a natural way to work. And so you can write in here, you know, I don't know what the word is, but you can actually write in by hand and it'll turn it into text. And you can I like having an eraser. I have to say, Apple should really consider that as well. It's actually really a natural thing to turn the pen upside down and start erasing. This is the Surface Book. This is the one with a crazy hinge. And I am very much in love with this. And I'm not, as you know, I am not a Windows guy. But they've done a lot of things quite nicely, I think, on this.
And I will say that I do like my Surface 3 a lot, and I do use it a fair bit.
You made it a pick of the week on MacBreak Weekly, which was considered anathema.
Because I just feel like Apple has missed the boat with the Mac Pros and everything. I mean, all these screens should be – you should be able to write on all the Apple screens and touch on stuff. And I get that they think that the OS has to do something special, but I'd be really just happy with it just being touch sensitive.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to add anything to the to the experience.
By the way, that was you didn't see it, but I just opened it up and it has the Hello face recognition built in. Recognized the face and unlocked it immediately. Does that very well. It's interesting cuz Microsoft has not been a player for some time and all of a sudden their first laptop and it's kind of lust-worthy. I'll probably buy an iPad Pro 2.
Of course you will.
It's my job. I have to do it.
Yes.
Actually, what we're going to do, I think we're going to have Megan Maroney, who co-hosts iOS Today with me, buy that one.
Right.
And I actually got the new Mini, which I really like a lot. We are in a minority, though, because according to the Pew folks, you know, they've been – it's the – what is it? The Pew Internet – it's the Pew Research Center, but they do regular surveys on how people use the internet and technology. And their most recent report, technology device ownership in 2015, was kind of interesting, especially among younger people, people under 30. Let me just see the methodology real quickly. They talked to 1,907 adults 18 and older in all 50 states. This is March 17th through April 12th. Most of the interviews were by phone, including cell phones, because a lot of the respondents didn't have landlines.
I don't have a landline.
But almost everybody had cell phones. Some interesting results. 68% of U.S. adults have a smartphone. 68%. That's up from 35% 4 years ago.
I was gonna say, it seems really low. Like
it's doubled.
Who doesn't have a cell phone?
It's not cell phone, smartphone.
Oh, smartphone.
Smartphone. Yeah. 86% of 18 to 29-year-olds have a smartphone. 83% of 30 to 49. It's the old folks like me.
Yeah.
We're still using
ours. My mom still has a flip phone.
Yeah. If you have an income of $75,000 and up, 87% have a smartphone. But what's interesting is tablet adoption, desktop computer adoption, you know, not great. Desktop computers actually starting to drop. Laptop computers, too. Tablet computers have basically leveled off in the last couple of years, as have game consoles. As you might imagine, MP3 players dropping slowly. E-book readers taking the biggest dive.
Yeah.
Only 19% report owning an e-reader.
I don't understand e-readers.
That's half what it was.
I mean, I get that it looks a little nicer, but I mean, I have my entire Kindle collection on my iPhone.
An e-reader looks
better.
Once
the phones are bigger. I mean, once the phones are big enough.
Yeah. And they're easier on your eyes as well, which is, for me, is a big deal. You know, I stare at LCDs all day long, and going to an e-ink display is so much nicer. But, you know, I get the convenience. It's frustrating for me, though, to think that, you know, the Kindle is probably a device with a limited shelf life, and we're all going to be reading on LCDs of some sort.
It is.
The Voyager is so nice.
Yeah, that's what I have as well.
It's so easy to read. It's so light.
I do wish it had a warmer backlight, though, because blue backlights are not good for sleep cycles.
I am told,
and of course, that's the last thing that you're looking at.
Now, I know, Tim, but I'm told it's not blue. It looks bluish.
Hmm.
But who was it told me that? Was it Calacanis? I think it was. Said that the e-ink light is not blue. Like, you know, because everybody's saying you shouldn't have blue light.
Yeah.
He said, no, it's not. But now you're right. It's not. Doesn't look warm, does it?
Sure looks blue to me. Yeah.
It's blue LEDs.
That's my only complaint with the thing. Yeah, I travel with that thing all the time. And it's one more device to pack, one more device to charge, and yada, yada. But it really is much nicer on my eyes. So that does bum me up. I know it's one of those things that's going away, just like video game consoles are going away, and that bums me out too.
Yeah, I like video. Are they going away? I guess they're not really going away, but we're not going to see – there's not going to be an Xbox 2. There's not going to be a PlayStation 5.
No, it's not going to be a hardcore gaming system. No.
I like the Voyage. I think the Voyage is really crisp. You know, it's more than $100.
Although the new Paperwhite just came out that has the same resolution as the Voyage, or it'll be out next week or something. So it doesn't have the glass screen and it doesn't have some of the other niceties, but I think it's like $120 or something. which then of course makes me want to buy the new Paperwhite. But then I know if I do that, literally at like the end of the month, the new Voyage will be out. So I want a new Kindle, but I'm going to have to wait for the next Voyage to come out before I make my decision. Well,
you're bucking the trend. 19% ownership.
I know, but I buy everything as
you
as,
and I. Yeah, all four of us.
Let's see this conversation going. Maybe I should buy one. Just to see.
Everybody on the Twit Network, and probably most of you watching and listening, has a problem. Let's just face it.
But it's our job. That's my argument. It's my job. My wife is like,
I claim it's my argument that I have to say, this is my job because I was doing this before this was my job.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Well, I became a computer journalist in the late 70s. Oh, God, I'm so old. And the main reason, I remember vividly, the main reason I started writing for magazines, I said to myself, I always want to own the latest, greatest technology.
Right.
That's my real goal.
Well, you've made
it. Yeah, I kind of made it. It's all I ever wanted. It's all I ever asked. And now, actually, now I'm going the other way. I'm going, oh, no, I don't have to buy another cell phone. I just got four. Mm-hmm. I don't want another cell phone. It's actually painful now. I'm sorry about the materialism. It's just that we feel we need to review these so that you at home don't have to buy four new cell phones. You can buy whatever the one that's the best is.
Perspective is very important.
Yes. I need to play with them all. MP3 players and computers declined by double digits among the 18 to 29 year olds. They're not buying computers. They've got a computer. It's called a smartphone. Let's see here. Cell phone penetration, including smartphones, is 98% among adults under 30. Smartphones, 86%. But the computers are dropping. In 2010, it was 88% penetration. Now it's 78%. So it's dropping. MP3 players, of course, going from 75% to half. Game consoles dropping. 2013, it was a 71% penetration. 2015, only 2 years later, 56%. It's a big drop there.
That hurts.
Tablet computers, really flat. Of course, it went up when the iPad came up because there was nothing really before that. There was some really bad tablets, but it's flattened out over the last few years. And that's why Apple's doing the iPad Pro. They've got to find some way to get people back into the marketplace. I don't know if that's the one that'll do it, especially considering the cost. Again, they make a... What is the smallest? It's 30. It's only two memory sizes, 32 and 128, right?
Yep.
It's weird.
Which makes sense. No, I think that they know that if they made a 64, they would never sell any 128s. And I think even Apple realizes that making a 16 gigabyte iPad Pro.
Even Apple can't do that.
Even Apple, the same people who think it's somehow okay to sell a 16 gigabyte iPhone, even they're like, you know what? Actually, not going to do that. That's not okay. And it's not okay. So I feel like, but if they made a 64 option, I don't feel like anyone would buy the 128.
Yeah.
Because the 32 is like, okay, we're going to put this out as a fleet for a large company. You know, some people,
exactly.
You know, and it's mostly cloud based. They're going to be using Salesforce or Google Docs or whatever. And I think the 128 is people are actually going to be roaming around and expecting to keep their content.
It's like with the 128, you know, that's where it could go into laptop replacement category. Whereas, like you said, you know, if you're running out of fleet of something, or if you're, you know, where most stuff is going to be based in the cloud, or you've got even virtual machine stuff happening or whatever, then that's fine. Right. But if you want to actually use it as a potential laptop replacement, you've got to have 128. And if we're being honest, even 128, you know, that's like the minimum level you have on a MacBook Air. So, you know, that's fair. It seems like a lot on a tablet, although for a laptop, it's not a ton. So it's interesting.
Apple, in its quarterly earnings this week, reported 9.9 million iPads sold, but that is a whopping 19.5% drop.
But I think that part of that is also that they did announce that they're releasing another product that isn't out yet, which is you almost
it's
always
been
hear.
Going down. It's, the
it's
third,
been going down for a while,
or fourth
but it's,
quarter, right?
But you're
yeah.
Gonna...
Well, this is probably 2 years on of declining stuff,
yeah.
And I have to wonder if some of it is because they don't yet still know like what the life cycle of an iPad is. I think this is one of the biggest problems. You know, when you and I, Leo, are talking about the fact that we don't know if we want the new iPad, right? Like that's an issue. When I'm going. You know, if I wasn't given an iPad Air 2 as a gift, I wouldn't have gone from the iPad Air to the iPad Air 2. I would have waited.
Right.
They're now not even releasing an iPad Air 3. They're literally going to keep it around for another year. So I don't know if they know what the life cycle or the upgrade cycle on these devices still is, you know, because there's still an awful lot of people who have iPad 2s and iPad Minis and iPad 3s. So they're not even on the Air kind of cycle yet. So it's like, okay, and then the apps still work. People use it primarily as a web browser. It's good enough. What's the point of upgrading it if you're mostly going to watch video, play games, and surf the web? You know, and that's, I think, been their biggest problem is that for a laptop, you've known, okay, you maybe have like a 3 to 4 year life cycle, maybe more or less, depending on what people are doing with it. But with a tablet, whereas a phone, you know that basically everybody wants to upgrade every 2 years because as those surveys are showing, this is the device we use the most. You know, you use your phone more than you use anything. And so there are some of us who upgrade more than once a year. There's some of us who have multiple phones. But I think the average person is probably that kind of 2 year life cycle, right? But with a tablet, we don't know. And as a product that's only 5 years old, I don't think Apple even knows yet like what the life cycle is. And that makes it really hard to then kind of, I guess, extrapolate numbers. Because and I've said this before, I feel like in the beginning, everybody underestimated the success of the iPad. And then they way, way, way overestimated it. And that's made it really difficult.
I think part of it is also that we aren't pushing the iPads very hard. I mean, I think that's the problem that PCs have had for a long time is that Excel goes as fast as it's ever going to go, you know, on a PC, you know, 5 years ago. And my kids were happily using a first generation iPad in, you know, switching back and forth between iPad 2, iPad 3, not thinking anything of it other than what games happened to be on that one until the screen died. You know, a couple
I
weeks
think
ago.
That's really it. We've reached a mature. These are mature products in a mature industry, and so there isn't the same kind of crazy growth because there's no the only you get a new one because it broke or it wore out, not because there's a feature that you have to have.
But also, it's not just that it's a mature product. It's that the developers aren't pushing the products that are coming out for these things aren't pushing the CPUs, even though you've got an A8 or A9 or whatever in there. It's not.
Nobody has said in years it's not fast enough, right?
Right. I mean, you can feel the difference. Like the new iPhone is much snappier than the last version.
It's not
but
like you would but miss it.
It plays everything. Yeah.
Right, and like you said, you know, the web browser is where I think it's weird. That's now kind of the bottleneck, and that comes down to a lot of other
factors.
Yeah,
we fixed that with AdBlock.
I was going to say, right? Did, right?
All better.
Yeah.
Right. So you know, that was kind of the bottleneck, but the apps are kind of written to go how they go. And a lot of developers optimize for the lower level hardware because they know that they still have a lot of users on that stuff. So yeah, it's like, okay, what's going to happen where on the phones you kind of can make the excuse that, well, we can't push things too much further because then battery life would be non-existent. But on tablets, it's interesting that we haven't seen anybody really try to kind of like really up the ante and kind of make it be like, you can't have this experience unless you have this device. But I almost have to wonder if that then becomes an issue for developers where they're going, do we really want to force people to upgrade to the latest tablets and risk not having any users? So I don't know. It's kind of a catch-22.
I think there's a tension between Wall Street's desire for a certain kind of hyper growth and the fact that there's not a lot. I don't think there's a lot you can do that's going to say, I need a faster system. I think these are mature. We're in a mature space right now. Phones aren't quite.
The only thing that could move things forward would be a focus on gaming, like what really accelerated PC growth back in the 80s and 90s. But ultimately, you know, the hot games on mobile are very simple games at this point that don't require
Apple TV
a lot of graphics.
That's last year's technology.
So if indeed, you know, as consoles continue to decline, if there is still a strong demand for that kind of gaming, and if indeed mobile devices can step in and fill that demand, then maybe there's an opportunity there for these things to grow. And at that point, you can start to make a case for annual upgrades as graphics get better. You need more powerful processors and all that good stuff. But by and large, you know, we've seen the mobile industry and the gamers in the mobile industry be very happy with very limited graphics and very limited gameplay. And so, you know, whether or not that can work, I don't know. But that seems to be the only hope, I think, that could help push things into a very saturated market.
Well, and the question really comes down to whether Apple should be investing in, you know, pushing ideas, whether they're developing or paying developers to do some of this, where they're what we're looking for is not just people developing stuff, but people that are going to push the outside envelope of what an iPad can do. If Apple spent $100 million a year investing in those things, it would definitely make that back if it created things that you have to have the new iPad for, you know, because I think that right now a lot of people are very comfortable with how do I develop something for the widest number of possible use cases, you know, so it's going to work every. I get frustrated when someone released an iPad only thing because I really just want to use my phone, you know, so, you know, I think that a lot of people develop for the widest market possible.
I think Apple sees this coming. And in fact, that's why in the earnings call, Tim Cook kind of downplayed how much growth there'd be in the holiday quarter. Didn't want to talk about how Apple plans to increase sales next year. Well, I think the message from Apple is, hey, we're doing good, but don't expect the same kind of growth you've seen in years
last
past.
Last quarter, last year for the quarter coming up, they made more money, I think more money in that quarter than any company in history.
Right.
And so now they're talking about having an incremental increase over
that.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we'll make 2% more than we made.
It's hard to get bigger than the biggest ever.
Ever.
It is.
39.3 million iPhones in Q4. This is Apple's Q4, mm-hmm. which is our Q2. Is that right? Or Q3? Q2. Apple sold 12.3 million iPads. Again, that's 20% drop. 5.5 million Macs. Cook did say Mac sales an all-time record. So thank goodness, because I want them to keep selling Macs. Mac sales are up 3.6%. I use a computer every day, yep. And I like to use a...
But I feel like I'm old fashioned using a computer. I mean, you go to when I'm at an airport, it's like you'll be sitting
everybody's
in the lounge.
Got tablets and
everybody's got tablets mm-hmm. and phones.
Yeah. It's interesting how spiky iPhone sales are because
we released a new one.
There's a new one and then it drops. Yep. There's a new one and then it drops. There's a new one. People are smart now. They've got they got Apple's cadence.
Right.
They know exactly when they want to buy. And I think that's everybody. They did beat estimates for the Mac, not so much for the iPad and the iPhone. But a good look at sales growth of 22.1% mm-hmm. in the iPhone.
I don't think anybody should be disappointed by those iPhone sales.
They made money.
At all.
They did okay.
Not only did they make money, they it's a huge growth year over year. I mean, and a year ago was like the biggest iPad sales or iPhone sales rather to that point, I think, for that quarter ever. And it was the next quarter, I guess their December quarter, where there had been a full cycle of iPhone 6 and 6 Plus sales, where they did like 70 million or some ridiculous number. So, I mean, the fact that they increased from what was already like their biggest, you know, Q2 or whatever a year ago, I think is a good sign. I mean, by estimates being off, they were off by like 500,000 units, which... when you're talking about as many as they sold, I feel like that's non-existent. They made it. I don't know.
Nothing more to say here. Moving along. Although Tim did say that one of the reasons iPhone sales were up is 30% of iPhone buyers are switching from Android. What we don't know is how many Apple buyers are switching to Android, but
right.
There's nobody to give that information out because mm-hmm. there's so many different companies that make Android phones. But 30% of iPhone buyers came from Android. Apple says that's the highest ratio of switchers.
That's huge.
Apple's big growth areas are China and switchers. I mean, that's mm-hmm. where they're
right.
expanding.
And I think those two areas are really connected, actually, because the Chinese smartphone market has been primarily Android, and as more and more Chinese users are upgrading or buying iPhones, they're coming from low-cost Android devices, by and large. Mm-hmm. There was a survey this summer that said that 50% of people who buy an iPhone in China are switching over from Android. So I think that is where a lot of that 30% is coming from.
Still no Android Apple Music.
Right. I know. That was supposed to already be out. It's very odd.
I wonder if they've decided against that. Maybe
They definitely haven't. No. From what I understand, they're still working on it, but it's just been weird that there's been radio silence about it. I think even Apple understands that if they want to legitimately have a shot at music, they can't ignore Android.
Apple does have a new Android app. It's its second Android app. The first one was moved to iOS.
Yeah, right.
The second one is called Beats Pill Plus. It comes, it goes along with the Beats Pill speaker, which you can buy in the Apple Store. So let me just look at this Beats Pill Plus app. It's in the Google Play Store. It lets you rename your pill. I would. First thing I do. I don't think Beats Pill Plus is a very good name. Of course, the Android fanboys immediately weighed in, whether they use the app or not. They didn't care. 167 one-star reviews, 63 five-star reviews, with an overall rating of 2.1.
That's hilarious. It's a fine app. I mean, it lets you use this DJ mode to send stuff, and you can connect two Beats pills together. I mean, it's completely and totally, you know, fine. There's nothing special about it. But I think the very fact that when they're releasing something for the Beats product line, the Beats people know that there still needs to be an Android app, shows that Apple recognizes, at least for some parts of their business, that they can't be completely iOS only.
Yeah. Well, good luck. Thomas Buckley II, 1 star. Obey, no thank you, Apple. That's what I, sheep, are used for. They blindly purchase.
Says the guy who probably only has like a Nexus phone or a Samsung. Right.
The modern technology we have Android users have had for years. Yeah, it's funny how people still fight these religious wars.
I'm just always amazed that they're willing to spend so much time reviewing something they don't have.
Just say, wait till you have it. You know, just use this as an opportunity to write a screed.
Because now Beats is evil.
Oh, it used to be hip. Now it's evil.
But now Apple bought them. You know, it was great when HTC bought them, and poor HTC.
Let's take a break. We'll talk about YouTube Red when we come back. The launch on Wednesday of YouTube's ad-free pay channel. PewDiePie says he knows why they did it. We'll find out. But first, a word from Citrix and GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with clients and coworkers all over the world. Nowadays, we don't just work with people in the same building. We work with people all over town, all over the country, all over the world. And think about all the travel time involved, the money, the hassle it takes to hold a meeting. The best way to do this is on the internet with Citrix GoToMeeting. It's a much smarter way to meet. First of all, it's easy to start a meeting, easy to do it on the fly, you know, ad hoc, or to use Outlook or some other device to click a button and automatically send an invitation out to everybody. Even if they've never used GoToMeeting, they'll be up and running within seconds. It quickly downloads the software, makes it very easy for them, no router modification or anything like that. And you can use it on anything, a computer, a tablet, a smartphone. You'll use the HD camera on your computer or your tablet so they could see you and you could see them. You'll be sharing screens so they could see what your PowerPoint presentation has, or you can collaborate on documents together. Your team will all be on the same page and seeing each other face to face. It's frankly, I would far prefer to hold a GoToMeeting than have a real meeting. We do it all. We do this with our screensavers show meetings, because I just don't want to come in. I stay at home.
I have 6 accounts.
You have 6 accounts?
Yeah. we use it. I mean, yeah. There's so many parallel meetings happening at the same time.
Wow.
We have
as many as 6 at once? Mm-hmm. Wow. GoToMeeting.com. Click the try it free button. You can try this free for 30 days. It's easy. It's fast. You'll be meeting in minutes. GoToMeeting from Citrix. We love it. You'll love it. PewDiePie says, YouTube Red exists because of ad blocking. And in fact, that's really the counter argument to paying $10 a month to YouTube not to see ads is, well, just run a free ad blocker. You won't see the ads anyway. Oops.
I don't buy that.
I was a subscriber to YouTube's Google Play Music. Right. And you get it with Google Play Music. With Google Play Music, I already got ad-free music videos on Google, and now I get that, plus I get the ability to play in the background. I wouldn't pay for it, but now that I've got it, I love it. It's kind of a weird experience to start a video and not have a pre-roll.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say that I think that a lot of this has to do with the fact that YouTube had to find – it's not so much YouTube needing to make more money I'm sure they'd like to, but the big issue is that the ad-based – revenues for the creators was too low, and YouTube had to find a way. I think in the long term, I think that's what they're. I believe that they're really looking for how do they to stay competitive as more and more, like as Facebook starts doing its own thing, as everybody else is doing. They have to be more competitive. They have to find ways Because especially in highly vertical markets, so you have a small number of people who are interested in what you're doing, advertising doesn't work at all. Like, really, advertising isn't even viable on YouTube if you have less than a million views per unit, in my opinion. And so,
oh, no, it's not. I mean, especially since YouTube won't let you sell your own ads.
Exactly.
I mean, let's be real. If YouTube really wanted creators of all sizes, even big ones, to make money from advertising, what they would do is they would say, you can sell your own ads, not you have to put our ads in front of this, but you can actually go out and have your own salespeople do it. And maybe we'll take a cut off the top, but you can sell your own ads. But they don't do that.
And I do believe they will let you run, that you can get into agreements where you can sell your own ads and give them a cut, but no one wants to do that either. And so
maybe at the very, very top, right, they do, but that's been one of the longstanding things why we haven't seen a lot of commercial programming on YouTube, is that they won't let the big studios make those sorts of deals. And I think the studios would be okay with giving them a cut, even if it was less than what YouTube might want, because they could get so much more and it could be so much better targeted. But that's why instead you have the PewDiePies of the world, Michelle fans, who have to all do, like, you know, sponsorship things. They have to have,
that's,
you know,
where they make their money, don't they?
And that's the people who have the most, right? Those are the people with the absolute most views are having to use these other sources. So clearly, I mean, I think that it's great to want to blame it on ad blockers and everybody. Then that makes a really kind of catchy headline. But the reality is that Google and YouTube really cared about making a better, you know, income for, or making the ad situation better for their creators, and they would let them have more control over the advertising process, but they don't. And so, this, I agree with you, Alex. I think in the long run, has the potential to give them more money. But I still feel like if you look at it, you know, why are ad rates so much higher on traditional television than they are on online video? Even things like the Super Bowl or even like NFL games, right? Like an NFL game spot that the Yahoo was able to sell went for way less than what it would sell for on TV, even though the potential size of the audience in the targeted size of the audience is in some ways better. Why? You know, there are a lot of reasons behind that, but if YouTube is really serious about making the ad play work, they would let their creators or the companies that do, you know, the maker studios of the world actually make their own ad deals, but they don't.
We, you know, we air all our shows on YouTube. We don't cut our interstitial ads out. In fact, we don't give YouTube a cut. All of our ads stay in.
Technically, you know,
we're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, technically, you're not supposed to.
No, we don't do that. Shh. Never did that.
The live version is the only place you'll hear that.
Did I mean that we? I meant that we don't do that.
Right. Exactly.
I say you're not supposed to do that.
You're not supposed to. There's a whole lot of. We do a lot of streaming. So I know a lot of the streaming rules, but you literally, there's a certain amount of time that a logo can be up. You can't run ads. You can't run. I mean, there's a whole bunch of rules around that.
See, when they started YouTube Red, they went out and they really strong-armed all the producers.
They said if you want to still be on us, you have to be on Red.
Yeah.
Is what they said.
You had to agree to this.
And they did the same thing with musicians when they first did the first YouTube music thing. They said, if you want to make your videos available on YouTube, period, then you have to agree to let other people either license your songs and then you'll get a cut, or you have to, you know, let us have this commercial free version. So
I was a little nervous when I heard about that. I thought, well, we're in trouble and nothing. I mean, we're on YouTube Red. I guess not legally. Is that right?
No, it's just your content has other stuff there. I mean,
we don't monetize. We don't check that box that says monetize.
Oh, well, then in that case, I mean, then it's a different situation.
I could do anything I want, right?
No, you can't. No, yeah, so.
Shh. Small enough.
But like, so for instance, though, the one thing you have to be careful of is, so Pixelcore, all of our stuff got turned off because I didn't realize that I had to go in and click my little complete the process. You know, so I just noticed that today someone posted, hey, we can't watch your video because it's been, so they are turning off your...
don't know what you're talking about.
They are turning off your videos if you don't sign the agreement. You know, because, you know, you either, so all your videos are going to private if you don't sign in, you know, agree to being part of the new network, which I'm fine with. I don't care. I mean, yeah sure.
Private means that the link still works, but it's not searchable, or it is not there at all.
It's not it just when you get it up there, it says you can't watch it in your region. This is a Pixel Core video.
So you, it's not. So, it's gone.
Yeah. So I and so then you get to this enable fan funding is what they're calling it, of course. And you have to enable it to be in good standing. And
Red is fan funding.
I believe that
that's what they're calling it. Yeah. Which is great that they make it seem like this is actually something that fans are
fans
they make
are
it
doing.
Sound like a Patreon, please.
Yeah.
Like fans really want to watch PewDiePie do a show that he's getting paid money for. Let's be very clear about that. His PewDiePie is Scared show. He's not paying anything for that. He's getting paid lots of money for that. And then if they pay $10 a month, they can watch people scare him, which no one is going to do that for the original content. But I do feel like people might subscribe for the ad-free experience. I don't feel like the original content will make anybody, I don't care who you are, want to pay for it on YouTube stuff. I mean, maybe once they have a Transparent or a House of Cards or an Orange is the New Black, it'll be a different story.
Do you think they will?
No, I don't. Because I feel like the people who are capable of making those sorts of programs are not going to YouTube. They're going to other places that, frankly, do a better job of monetizing and let them advertise in a better way, frankly.
I think they will go to YouTube if Google wants them to go there. It's just going to take a lot of money, just like it took a lot of money for Amazon to go get Jeremy Clarkson and the Top Gear guys to come over
and do that there.
But, well, Jeremy was out of work.
Right, but ultimately he could have gone anywhere they wanted to go, and then he decided to go there because
and Amazon paid $2 million. But do you think that Google's going to do that? I mean, Susan Daniels.
I don't see why not.
Well, because they've been so against it. I mean, Robert Kinkle for years has been against that, and I know that the new person she used to run MTV and MTV's original programming is making kind of the big effort with this. But I wonder if, again, without actually letting people sell their own advertising, if that's kind of the play you're trying to do, if they can attract like that level of talent to them.
If it's YouTube content, if it's YouTube wholly owned content, just like Netflix owns House of Cards, and ultimately there's no question about advertising. It's just you're paying to get into this service that is then providing you with top level content. Ultimately, I don't think YouTube needs to do that. They've obviously shown that they can do really, really well with user generated content, make a whole lot of money that way. And I think that's their path going forward.
Does YouTube
But if they
make
wanted
money?
To be in the premium content market, they could.
Does YouTube make money?
Oh, that's true. They've been successful. Well, they're not too profitable.
They have revenue. I don't think they make any money. They lose money.
I don't think they're profiting from it. I think that
wouldn't it be smart? I mean, look what benefit Netflix got from House of Cards. $100 million. That's all they had to do is write a check. I remember Dana Brunetti was telling us, he's the producer. He said, you know, we were all set to do a deal with a big cable company, probably HBO. We were all set, and I got a phone call the night before. And they said $100 million. You can launch all the episodes of season one all at once if you want complete creative control. He said, "Okay, hold on." He called Kevin Spacey.
Oh, they didn't even get international rights. I mean, that was the best part about it for Brunetti.
You'll keep international rights.
Keep international rights.
And so he called Spacey and said, "I know, Kevin. I know we were about to do this deal, but what about this?" And Spacey said, "What the heck? What could we lose?" And they did it. And so I don't see any reason. And Google going to somebody like that would have even more clout, I think.
But they definitely would.
They need the will to do it. I understand they don't have the will to do it.
That's my whole question is, do they have the will to do
it?
Why wouldn't they? Money. Because they've been so against that. I mean, they honestly have like been so against that. The creators have been asking them to do this for years, and they've not wanted to
do
it.
Now, if they did that, I would actually seriously consider a YouTube Red subscription,
right? But until you have that level of content, all I'm saying is right now, until you have that level of content, nobody, and I mean nobody, is going to pay $10 a month so they can see some PewDiePie stuff.
I completely agree. Especially because PewDiePie's audience is mostly too young to afford $10 a month.
Well, they are. And not only that, but PewDiePie is still going to make, because he understands the bulk.
He makes 12, according to Fortune, he makes 12, or Forbes, he makes $12 million a year. How much of that comes from YouTube advertising? How much of that comes from YouTube? And how much of that comes from other things like product placement?
But most of it comes from product placement. I think most of it comes from product placement, but
YouTube would like you to think he gets a $12 million a year payday from us, but it isn't from YouTube.
Well, but it is. But it is. It's not directly. It's not like YouTube's writing the check, but make no mistake, he wouldn't be getting that product placement. He wouldn't get those views if it were on a platform that weren't like YouTube. Maybe he could do it on Twitch, but I think the fact that YouTube is free, it's accessible, it's on everything, is a big part of his appeal.
One parent did write me an email saying, hey, really, I would pay because ad-free content for younger children, and you have younger children, is
like
definitely
I said, for ad-free. Mm-hmm. I think people pay to get rid of ads, but at least right now, until Google shows that they're serious about actually wanting to bring in the creative community, and they haven't done that yet. I don't think, I mean, and when I looked at the slate of shows they announced, I was like, what is this? Is this like the UPN launch from 1995? Like, it's some terrible stuff, right? Like, it's seriously terrible stuff that no one's going to pay for, but that doesn't matter. They don't necessarily have to pay for the originals. If they're paying even $10 just to get rid of the ads, whether it's parents or people who have the
Alex, I mean, you have small kids. What would you...
The reason that we don't have TV at home is not because I'm cheap. Or I don't. It's specifically because I have got little kids and ads. And the thing is that we turned TV on for 2 months, and the level of requests that came from them went from zero to insanity. You know, like of all this crazy stuff that they wanted and everything else.
None of it works.
And then we immediately turned it off, and then they went back to being
Abby
very
did the
happy.
Same thing. Watching. Weebles wobbles, but they won't fall down. Yeah. She had to have... Right. All of that crap.
And I was like, oh, I don't need any of this.
I'm sorry, so. Tim was going to say, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Tim. Go ahead.
I was going to ask if anyone else is optimistic that this could spread across other areas of the internet as well. You know, Google already has the option to buy a certain number of ads on web pages. And I'm pretty excited by the opportunity for people to pay for ads to go away and making that a bit more of a visible thing. I think this is a great way to move that idea forward. And ultimately, I think that's the way that the internet grows going forward. You know, we've already seen the continuing battle between ad blockers and banner ads and how banner ads are just getting uglier and uglier and users want to opt out of that. I do think that we need a major player to come in and really make it a viable option for people to be able to pay money to make ads go away or a significant number of ads go away. And I would like to think that maybe this sort of thing could grow into that kind of thing where you pay not only $10 a month to make YouTube go away or YouTube ads go away, maybe you pay $15 a month and every Google ad that's anywhere goes away. Maybe you pay $20 a month and that extra $5 then goes to other ad networks and their ads go away. I would love to see that kind of thing.
I think
Google is the only one who could really make that happen.
I happily pay $10 a month to Google Contributor because this is the deal where it takes Google ads off of some blog pages and instead gives them money from a percentage of the money you give them. And the most you can give as a contributor is $10.
I think that's a great program. It's just so limited right now that it doesn't make sense for a lot of people to pay that.
Yeah, look, a penny went to Android Police. A penny went to Greenbot, and less than a cent went to some other sites that are unknown. But I can invite contributors expanding. We need your help to invite people who would like to be contributors. Anybody want an invite? I have 50 invites. anybody who's a blogger or has you'd have to have Google Ads on your site,
right?
Which who doesn't? If you would like an invite, let me know, because I'd love to share that with you. I mean, this is an interesting idea. This is all, by the way, this is clearly in response to ad blockers.
Well, I do think that YouTube Red is initially about getting rid of the ads, but I think the real push is going to be custom content that's only available to the Red subscribers.
Well, start doing that, and I'll pay for it. But right now, there's nothing for me.
I know, but I'm saying, eventually, 2 years from now, I think the conversation we're going to be having is the cool series that's only on YouTube Red, that type of thing.
Well, the irony is they really should push the fact that you get Google Play Music.
Yeah, right. They should.
Because that's what I pay for Google Play Music.
Now, I'm not understanding. I don't know if this is happening because I was part of the YouTube Music Key beta, and then they switched over. But for some reason, it's telling me that my YouTube Red account, which will apparently charge me on December 1st, 2015, is $7.99. Does anybody know why?
Yeah, I pay $7.99 too. The people who signed up in the earliest days of when it was still called Google Music Key. Paid $7.99, and they said that will be for life. So that is you and I and anybody who signed up in the earliest days have a great deal.
So I'm never, So I'm never going to not be paying. Okay. This is yet another $8. I'm out.
You're stuck. $8 a month for the rest of your life.
It's $300 a month, though.
Yeah, it's really going to pay off then. But I noticed, because I didn't pay for YouTube Red, but I do subscribe to it. They call it Google Play Music now. I do subscribe to that. I love it because I can upload all my songs to it. And those are added to the streams. And by the way, I also love them because they're adding podcasts soon.
Yes. I was going to say, the podcast thing is interesting because I think in that case, they are doing a weird thing where like they can insert their own ads or something.
There is language in there that they can add post-rolls. Not insert, but they can add post-rolls, which personally, I couldn't care less. Right. As long as I can continue to have my ads in there and they don't put pre-rolls on it, which they don't. Unless I choose to monetize.
I think it's fine. It's interesting. It's also interesting to me that the guy who wrote the blog post about the podcast thing is Elias Roman, who He's the former CEO and co-founder of Songza, which Google acquired last year. And Songza, I know they were looking at one point getting into podcasts, and I honestly wanted Spotify to buy Songza. They bought Tunigo instead, which Songza was a far superior product. But it's interesting to me, knowing all the – Elias is a really smart guy, and knowing all the stuff that Songza did, it would be interesting if they were able to kind of take the podcast thing and help you listen to the right podcast for the right time of day.
I think that's exactly what the plan is. We were early NDA'd partners. I couldn't talk about it, but we now that it's public, I can. So we're one of the launch podcasts. They aren't going to launch, though, they say, for months. I don't know why months. But they right now they're getting podcasters to submit feeds. But it's my understanding that exactly what you just said, Christina. So what Songza, so here's my Google music interface. What Songza does is it says it's Sunday evening, play music for working out, making dinner, game day, hanging out, relaxing at home. And then within relaxing at home, you choose classic rock relaxation. And within that, there's three radio stations. Podcasts will be in there. So if the example Elias gave is, I need to cheer up. Play some upbeat, fun podcasts for me. So discovery will be a part of that. And that's a big deal for podcasters. It's funny, less so for me, I think. But if you're a new podcaster, a huge thing. So I'm thrilled to see this. And this will be installed by default on Android phones. So it's the first podcast app. You know, there have always been podcast apps on iOS and on Windows Phone. This is the first time they've done this on Android. So that's, I think, very good news. Now, some of this is to compete with Twitch.
Yes.
Going on right now, Twitch is launching a new channel called the Creative Channel. Going on right now, the Bob Ross Marathon.
This is the greatest thing in the entire world.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic.
How many people are watching it right now?
Did you know that Bob Ross used to be in the military? It's kind of hard to imagine.
Oh, my God.
I can see him shouting with an M16 in his hand.
Currently, 51,000 people are watching it. A total of 1.7 million have watched. They have 254,000 likes. The chat room in this is hysterical.
It is. It's like when Twitch plays Pokemon. It's like that sort of experience again, except people discovering this magic for the first time ever. And
Bob Ross,
I have to say,
was a painting teacher on PBS. He's passed away.
He's been gone for like 20 years.
Yeah,
he's
much beloved. He did The Joy of Painting. Yeah.
Joy of Painting is amazing. PBS did this thing a couple of years ago where they did these great remixes of classic PBS stuff. Like they did one of Mr. Rogers and they did one of him and they did one of Sesame Street. And the Bob Ross one was one of their most popular. So I'm not surprised with its success, but I just want to point out 51,000 people tuning into this live at this time. It's sunny, at 7 p.m.
This is the big television night.
I was going to say, this is if you were to go to like any major like cable news network right now, more people are watching Bob Ross. He runs on PBS.
A lot more people are watching it than are watching us.
It's fantastic.
So I think this is fantastic. By the way, you can subscribe. So apparently they're going to do something new, Twitch Creative. So Twitch.tv, which is the game, you know, the Let's Play gaming version of spinoff of Justin.tv, which eventually got sold to Amazon, by the way. Amazon owns this. And Justin.tv shuttered. They're also doing, you mentioned Twitch plays Pokemon. They're doing the same thing, trying to install Linux right now. This is a somewhat lesser viewed channel. Only 1,750 people right now watching Twitch installs Arch Linux. And it's the same idea. You have to cooperatively enter into the chat room the commands.
That's amazing.
To get this. And they've come quite a way, frankly, since I saw this before. So it's a vote-based system.
Oh, this is fantastic.
In which,
this is the nerdiest thing I've ever seen. Yeah. I love it.
Trolls are competing with real people to do the right thing. A lot of people want to do no-op now.
I love it. I'm rooting for the trolls in this case because that's just so much fun.
Isn't it fun?
Oh, my God. I mean, because at first when I saw this, I was like, who wants to watch anyone install Arch? I mean, come on. But this is brilliant. They should do Gentoo next. That would be really fun.
Well, the nice thing about Arch is it's really complicated.
Well, I know. That's why I said they should do Gentoo next, because Gentoo's even harder.
Yeah, because you have to unroll everything. Oh, my gosh. Exactly. So I love Twitch. I have to say, this kind of creativity really makes me happy. And this is something that has to scare YouTube, because really YouTube's, I would say, one of their top categories is Let's Play videos, right?
Honestly, it goes back to being willing to spend money for content. Why did YouTube not pay whatever it cost to buy this?
Right.
I mean, why would
I think they tried. I don't know how Amazon got it. I think they tried.
So I know that they made an offer. So I'm saying, you know, like, close the deal. To me, I don't understand, like, close the deal. This is clearly such a huge part of their future. And for one of their competitors who is clearly not messing around in video and is already way ahead of the game with the quality original content, like,
by the way, can you think of a cheaper kind of content than buying up the Bob Ross catalog? I mean, next it'll be Happy Days. I mean,
because
of the community involvement in this, you could play any sort of crap. You could have a Hawaii 5-0 marathon.
No, we should do, Tim, you'll appreciate this. We should do Beverly Hills 90210. We should petition that, because Tim and I have talked for years about wanting to recreate the opening of Beverly Hills 90210 with tech journalists. I would be Brenda, obviously. Tim would be Dylan. And I feel like it's important to bring a show that's been that was on the air 25 years ago to a new generation of teenagers.
Is there an old man role in the open? Anything I could play?
You could be one of the dads.
Brendan's dad, I think, would be a great fit for you. But we're just looking for funding this, folks, people. So if you'd like to see the remaking of Beverly Hills 90210, just ping either Film Girl on Twitter or Tim Stevens on Twitter _. Send your money our way and we'll make it happen.
Couldn't you Kickstarter this? I mean, this would be huge.
It's not bad. It would probably do pretty well, actually.
It probably would do pretty well.
I think that what it shows is that you could take almost anything and add a live interactive community with it, and the community becomes the entertainment here.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's almost useless. I mean, that wall of...
It goes so fast.
It goes so fast. You know, it's not... but it's... I think what's really happening is you've got 48,000 people watching...
It's kind of amazing.
Bob Ross.
So shouting
more than ever saw him on PBS at one time.
Anarchy versus Democracy.
Yeah. There's his puffy little clouds he's so famous for.
Oh, nice little puffy clouds.
I watched a documentary on him a little while ago, and apparently he hated that hairdo, but it became such a trademark for him that he couldn't get rid of it. So he had it, like, in the first season, it just sort of became his trademark that he
I
he
want to cut my afro off, but I can't.
But he had to keep
but
it because
it
of
by brand.
In branding.
Wait, listen, let's listen.
For little rascals, aren't you just put as many as you want in your seascape? Or as few? Maybe you don't want evergreens in yours. Maybe you want to have some old trees that hang over and lean, and that's all right. Anything that you want.
He was kind of a genius.
He was such a genius.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
All right, well, thank you, Twitch, for introducing Bob Ross to a whole new generation of gamers.
It does seem like the exact opposite, like, personality for Twitch.
It does, but that's what's great about it.
Yeah.
Took a break from squatting on people in Halo 5 to watch Bob Ross.
Yeah. Bob Ross teabags his paintings.
oh, God.
That's how you get puffy little clouds. I'm just saying. all right, we're going to take a break now on that note. Oh, Lord. Mm. Our show today brought to you by... are you a mobile app developer? Are you actually, it's interesting, we're talking about Braintree, the best way to add a payments infrastructure to your mobile app. And you know, if you need know nothing else, just look at who uses Braintree. Uber, the magical Uber. I mean, that's the payment in Uber is the key to the whole thing. You get the ride, they come to you, you get in the car, you get out of the car, everything's handled. There's no button to push or anything. That's Braintree. Their V.0 SDK. Airbnb uses it. GitHub uses it. So, yeah, originally Braintree, I think, was designed for the web, and they added the mobile payments. By the way, it's not just Uber. Lyft also uses it, and that's when you know. When you get Hotels Tonight and Airbnb using it. When you get competitors using the same payment solution, this is a full-stack solution. Gives you fast payouts, continuous support, from your first dollar to your billionth dollar. They are on the cutting edge of e-commerce. And you're ready with Braintree to accept everything. Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, Bitcoin, everything. Bitcoin. Helping companies convert visitors into customers is Braintree's reason for being. We talked the other day to Ankur Arya. He's the general manager for Braintree Mobile. You remember they bought Harper Reed's company. What's it called? Modest. And what the Harper Reed's company was doing ended up being this buyable pins program. Have you seen this on Pinterest? We asked him about this.
The holy grail for Pinterest was to figure out a way to integrate a commerce experience into the core Pinterest product discovery experience. And so buyable pins is the ability for Pinterest users to actually buy products that they like directly through the Pinterest interface, right? So instead of having to click away to a merchant's checkout page, you know, that buying experience now is squarely within the Pinterest UI. And so they've got some really great retailers that have signed up for this, Neiman Marcus, Nordstrom, among others. And so we've been working with Pinterest for the last several months to help power this experience.
The whole idea is friction-free. And as a developer of a mobile app, this is what you want, a full-stack payment solution, support for every payment type your customers want, easy integration for you, cross-platform solution, superior fraud protection. By the way, that's why you don't want to write this yourself. You want Braintree's expertise here. And of course, they've got great customer service for you and fast payouts. And that's important too. Check it out. You'll get your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free at BraintreePayments.com/twit. Hey, before we get back to the news, if you missed anything this week, you know, this was Halloween week. We had a lot of fun playing Halloween games on Twit. Watch.
Previously on Twit.
If blood, guts, and horror make you queasy, then this is not for you, and you have my permission to fast forward. I'll give you a second. Okay, now that we got those wimps out of here.
iOS Today.
This is The Walking Dead, Dead Yourself. There it is.
That's pretty bad.
Before you buy.
The Huawei Nexus 6 P. Without a doubt, one of the best Android devices on the market right now. It checks pretty much all the boxes. And finally, we have a device that does, and it happens to be Nexus.
The new screensavers.
South by Southwest decided to cancel two panels due to pressure from online harassers.
They were sending a signal out there that would have had a very terrible precedent that all you need to do is to threaten a venue and basically the people you're targeting will not get a chance to speak.
i5 for the iPhone.
Last week, Apple rolled out iOS 9.1. The real news, of course, is the 150 new emoji. So now we can express ourselves with a hugging face, a thinking face, and a middle finger. But if you're going to give someone the middle finger, you really ought to do that in person.
Twit, making the world safe for technology.
We both have our costumes on today,
yes,
right?
Yes, I'm a naughty priest.
Yes, Bob Ross is still painting.
Well, you I think anything you want.
I think what Twitch is going to do with this is have other artists, and you'll watch. I mean, like, wouldn't you want to watch Burt Monroy and other artists working? So this
I would watch even somebody that I don't even know. You know what I mean? If somebody, I mean, that was what made Joy of Painting so great. Is I remember watching it as a kid. Like, you would feel like you could actually do it, even though you knew that if you bought the paints, you wouldn't actually be able to do it yourself. But there's something just mesmerizing about it.
You know
what
this is? This is why we watch cooking shows, right? You may not make that recipe ever. It's just very soothing. It's like watching mom in the kitchen, just watching somebody cook. And I think watching artists is very similar. And what's interesting is Twitch is going to have the franchise in this. Right. You know, this is going to be, the creative channel is going to be the new cooking channel. Right.
Mm-hmm. Very smart. And well, then a creative channel could split into a cooking channel on its own.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But this is, I mean, it's brilliant. It's really brilliant. And the community aspect, I feel like that's a big part of it because it feels like you're in there with other people, even if you're not reading it. You're sharing, it's a shared experience.
I just look at what they're typing. It's just completely rubbish.
I know. And then you get all these new, they have all these sticker. There's a Bob Ross avatar sticker. They have all these stickers in here.
I'm sure it means something to someone. It's just...
Oh, no, this is a whole culture. In fact, you see this black and white one that keeps going by? That is one of the early Justin TV employees, and it actually became a meaning. I just read an article about this. It has a meaning of its own that in the Twitch community is meaningful. I don't know. I love you, Bob. Love you, Bob Ross. All right. Moving right along. Big story, and I don't know if it's true, but the Wall Street Journal had it. They said Google, starting soon and completing this by maybe 2017, plans to fold Chrome OS into Android. Android is the winner. There will be one Google operating system going forward. I'm actually a little disappointed by this.
I just thought it'd be the other way around because Android's kind of forked.
Yeah, who's
into
the big winner, though? I mean,
it is.
Who's the big? Who's the most used operating system in the world? Number one.
Yeah. Well, the many faces of it. I mean, right. I think that's the thing is that Google has a lot more control over Chrome than they have over Android.
Well, but this will be a Google-controlled OS, I think, and that's part of it is trying to get Android back in the Google fold.
Right.
The thing is, I think they're different. You know, it's funny. I've come around on this. When Chrome OS came out, I was completely skeptical. The Chromebook seemed like a dopey idea. Why would I buy a computer that's only a browser?
Right.
I was convinced. Kids, most users nowadays don't need a full-blown operating system.
Well, and a lot of schools
complexity
have gone
and
from,
security. Yeah,
from iPads to Chromebooks.
This is the right solution. It's secure. I mean, really secure. Deep down at its roots, secure. It does, like, everything that 99% of people want to do. I mean, most people, all they do is internet and email. It'll do that. No problem. I don't understand why you want to add an app store. The security issues that are introduced by more than a million apps, it surprises me.
Can't you provide the same experience through Android, though, effectively, by creating a custom version or some subversion of Android that effectively only runs Chrome, so that effectively you have basically the Chrome app running within the Android operating system? And so any extensions
Chrome
that
OS.
You make to...
right, what's but that the distinction?
Way, at that point, you're limiting your developer pool, and the extensions that are made then to the Chrome browser there then get ported back to Android as well. And it makes your life a little bit easier without having to support these two completely separate operating systems.
It's a small difference because really both are based on Linux.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I guess the biggest difference is Android is Java sitting, you know, in a special Java virtual machine, Dalvik or the new one, which is called Art. Chrome is not. It's a direct. It's direct code, right? I don't know. I mean, it feels like going to Java is going backwards, but I might be wrong on that. It is credible. It's coming from the Wall Street Journal. They usually seem to get these stories right. They say that. Android was an almost retro approach within the company because it focused on devices that only worked when software and apps are downloaded onto them. And Google is a cloud company. Chrome OS is a cloud OS, you know?
Right.
Most of what you do is in the cloud.
Yeah, it seemed to me as it was going to go one direction. It always seemed like it would go the other way.
Go that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway.
Evidently not.
Well, I guess you'd have to keep both. You can't get rid of Android. I mean, Android is dominant.
Mm-hmm. Android is Android.
It's Android. So I guess that makes sense. And you're right, Tim. You do leverage the popularity of Android.
I mean, I would think that, too. I mean, a big part of the reason you would want to do this would be, I mean, obviously Chrome is more secure and can have those benefits. But why would you give up the app ecosystem?
Right.
Why would you give up some of the offline caching stuff? Because, you know, that is still one of the big things with the Chromebook is you do need to have a connection. And if you pay for, you know, their ridiculously priced Wi-Fi or, you know, LTE things, then that's fine. But a lot of people don't want to do that. I think that it'll be interesting to see how they implement apps and if maybe apps can run on their own kind of, like Linux, you know, like instances so that it doesn't, potentially conflict with the more secure stuff on your system. I think they could do some interesting things with it because fundamentally, I mean, it's a Linux kernel for both.
That would
of
be part of what Android would give you as well. Sandboxes for each app. You know, sandboxes aren't perfect. We've certainly seen exploits and all sorts of problems there. But in theory, you know, each app would indeed be running within its own sandbox. It would be a secure environment, you know, as secure as Android is and can be anyhow. So it's not perfect, but, you can provide that within there. And again, I think the main benefit would be any then extensions, any moves forward that you make, then get ported back to Android automatically without having to have two developer teams working in sync and trying to keep the same browser in parallel on multiple platforms.
It makes the Pixel C make a lot more sense. When we first saw it, I thought, why is that Android? That really ought to be a Chromebook.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, if it's, you know what, I would be really interested in this if it were kind of a Crandroid.
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 And we have a title.
Sounds delicious.
What is the name for this? Is it? It's the first Crandroid tablet.
It's good for your kidneys.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. That's right. The Pixel C is going to be... when is that out, by the way? They announced it. I don't see any...
We still don't know exactly.
Yeah.
I don't think we have a date.
This is the one with the magnetic snapping keyboard. And
I'd be really interested if what they did in this regard ended up being the kind of thing where, you know, Android's great on smaller screens. Chrome OS, I have to imagine, would not be great on a very small screen. Yep. But we know that it sings, that its comfort zone is like in that laptop kind of style category. Chrome OS as a touch-only interface, period, kind of doesn't really work either. It's nice to have the integrated touch, but it's not perfect and
no, I agree
only
with
touch.
You. And touch, as we were talking before the show, I've been convinced now by the Surface Book, everything should have touch, even yes. desktop operating systems.
As an option, right. So if you end up with something like the Pixel C, which, by the way, the minute I heard of it, it scares me because I don't believe that Android itself is great in that
this
like,
is,
keyboard
by the
type
way,
environment.
Jason Howell, host of All About Android.
Sorry.
And Android App Arena, our producer. I'm just saying, you know where you speak here. Yeah.
And so it kind of, this kind of, I was a little afraid of it when I first heard of it. If we got this and it was the kind of thing where, when it's in tablet, when it's pulled out as a tablet, you're working in Android. Yeah. When you pop it into that keyboard, it knows, all right, this is productivity mode. Let's switch over to Chrome OS and give you an environment that's tailor-made for that. I'd be really into that, actually. I think that's the best of both worlds.
Do you even need to do that? I mean, all you do is you open Chrome on this device, even though you're in Android. And now if the Chrome has all the capabilities of Chrome OS, you're in Chrome OS.
I suppose so, yeah.
The thing about Chrome OS that Android doesn't have is all of that security, the power washing.
Yeah.
Chrome OS does some amazing things with boot. It actually has two kind of versions of the firmware, and it validates one before it will use it. I mean, it just does so many brilliant things. It's totally devoted to making a secure system. Now, if we could bring that to Android, that becomes a very interesting play, because that's where Android is starting to lose some ground to iOS, is in security, right?
Maybe that's the goal. Maybe the goal is to basically take those resources that are at this point maintaining Chrome OS and bring that smart Android. And then also, as Jason is suggesting, bring the desktop usability of Chrome OS to Android, which you definitely lacks. I mean, even if you do put it into a laptop environment, the buttons are too big. The typography isn't great for what you would expect from a desktop environment. So if it could do the best of both worlds and learn a lot from Chrome OS, I think that'd be pretty great. It would be an interesting move for Google to start moving into the laptop world, too. You know, they've had laptops in the past, but they've never been a mass market machine. This could be if it were low cost enough, and it probably would be.
What if you incorporated the apps? What if you really kept it to Chrome OS, but you just incorporated the Android App Store and Android apps into Chrome OS so that I could?
Well, they tried to.
They
do
were
that.
Moving that way, right?
Yeah,
they're moving that way. I mean, but I think to Tim's point, I think that you've got to have your resources best executed. And in a lot of ways, you're trying to reinvent the wheel twice, right? Like, it seems like they're trying to do the same thing in two different places. So, you know, I think we all expected this to happen, this convergence to happen, which one would win. Maybe there was a difference of opinion. I always expected Android would win because it's bigger and it's obviously way more widespreadly used. But I mean, just because they're going in one direction, this way, you know, their conversion doesn't mean that the Android implementation on the laptop would be exactly the same as it is on the phone. You know, there would be nothing to stop them from kind of maybe making this hybrid thing, but it would still fundamentally be Android-based.
Makes the Pixel C a lot more interesting.
It does. It does. I mean, it makes it kind of look like the future.
Yeah. Crap, one more thing I got to buy.
Although if this isn't gonna happen for another year or two, it kind of makes the Pixel C not that awesome because you're stuck with Android in a keyboard environment for however long.
So the journal implied that you would start seeing this move soon. It wouldn't complete till 2017.
Got it.
That sounds like the Pixel C.
Yeah, and could be a big reason why they've given us very little information up to this point.
You buy the Pixel C, you're buying into the Crandroid platform. I don't care.
You put a trademark on that right now.
It's not Chrome Droid. That's dumb. Crandroid.
Crandroid.com. I'm checking.
Christina, you do a podcast every week with Brianna Wu, don't you?
I do.
We had Brianna on the new Screensavers yesterday, along with Alex Chu, talking about this mess at South by Southwest. I want to take a break. When we come back, I'm very curious what you think about this.
Sure.
And what the panel thinks. But I think because you work with Brianna, because you're a woman, I think you might have, you know, more standing in this than I do. And then I got a lot of heat because I conflated it with Gamergate, which didn't seem to me to be too far-fetched. But let's get to the bottom of it in just a second. Before we do, though, a word from Stamps.com, a great way to stop going to the post office. Post office, by the way, loves Stamps.com. Why? Because it's with Stamps.com at your desk, you could do everything you would do at the post office. You at your desk, in your office, you can buy and print official U.S. postage. You don't have to have a postage meter, your own computer, your own printer, no special inks. You can print postage for any package class, from a postcard to a letter to certified mail to return receipt to international media mail. Everything you would do at the post office, you can do at your desk with Stamps.com. It'll give your business a more professional look. If you're selling on eBay or Amazon, you got to have Stamps.com. No more handwriting addresses on letters and packages. You'll have barcoded postage with return and delivery address in one step, and it's automatically pulling that information from the website, putting it right on the envelope if you're sending something in an envelope. Your mail looks fantastic. For shipping labels, you could put the company logo right onto the label. And then if you're doing international mailing, it fills out the customs forms automatically for you. You get a discount that you can't even get at the post office. Discounted package insurance with one click of the mouse. And then the mail carrier comes and picks it up for you. Any size package. It is fabulous. The post office loves Stamps.com. You're going to love Stamps.com. No more driving to the post office. No more time wasted parking, waiting in line to get the mailing done. And this time of year is the last time of the year, you know, the last time you want to go to the post office. You got to try it. We got a special offer for you. Go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner there. Enter our offer code, which is TWIT, TWIT. And you're going to get a really good deal. You get a $110 bonus offer. It includes $55 in free postage. Free postage, you have to spread it out over the first few months, but that's still a great deal. You get a digital scale, so you never have to put more postage on than you think you need or less. No more. I mean, it's always exactly right. The scale's worth $50. You do pay shipping and handling on the scale. That's about $5. They make that up with a $5 supply kit. And, of course, you get a one-month trial of Stamps.com. Stamps.com. We use it here. I think every small business should use it because it makes you look like a big business. And it's easy and it saves you money and on and on and on. I don't know why you're not using it. Why don't you go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, enter the word TWIT, and see for yourself. Stamps.com. I guess I'd never met Brianna. It was really great to talk to her yesterday. And so what happened at South by Southwest? There were two panels.
There were going to be two panels, one that was kind of led by people who were associated with Gamergate, more on the pro-Gamergate side, and then one that was dealing not specifically with Gamergate, but more with the over idea of harassment in gaming, of which Gamergate has obviously been a part. And so they were both going to be part of South by Southwest. South by Southwest didn't really do a good job of explaining how the pro-Gamergate panel, which the circumstances, from what I understand, of how it was even allowed into the process and how voting took place seemed a little sketchy, was going to be there. And when people found out, people on the other panel and people in general obviously were upset. And then South by Southwest made the decision to say, okay, well, we're going to take this criticism aimed at us and just not have any panels on this at all. And then people got really mad, and Vox and BuzzFeed threatened to leave South by Southwest altogether, and it became this complete PR nightmare, and frankly still is for them a PR nightmare. And now they're saying they're going to have this harassment summit, like this whole day talking about harassment. But now it turns out it looks like the pro-Gamergate panel might actually be part of the harassment summit. So, or at least the panel, excuse me, not the pro-Gamergate panel, the panel that is made up by people who are largely on the side of people who are in support of the Gamergate movement will be on this panel too, which then makes people on the opposite sides feel like, how can you have a harassment panel when summit when people who we perceive as being part of our harassment are going to be in the same room with us and be part of the same, you know, set of events. And so it's kind of a nightmare.
So one session was called Save Point, a discussion on the gaming community. The other was called Overcoming Harassment in Games. South By said that they were canceling both panels because they feared for the safety of both panel both panels. No,
apparently threats were made
against the Save Point panel.
I'm not even sure. I don't know. And they weren't very clear on that. They just made it seem like that threats were made and they were worried about the sanctity of South by Southwest. So, and let's be very clear here. In my opinion, South by Southwest ceased being anything other than like a summit and kind of a place for brands and marketers to kind of have like spring break.
Is spring break for geeks at this point.
Well, no, it used to be geek spring break. Now it's marketer spring break.
It's CNN think, spring break.
honestly, it's marketer spring break. And I say this as someone who's been going to South by Southwest Interactive for the last 8 years, who my husband and I went from being coworkers to, like, he's now my husband at South by Southwest 2008. Like, it's an important event.
So, like, Twitter, you're a South by Southwest baby.
Yes, completely. Yeah. And so I've been going to it for a long time. I've been speaking on it almost every single year since like 2007. And the 1 year I didn't go was like the year that it was like a month before I was getting married and I had other things I had to do. And so I love South by Southwest, but it's not even really geek spring break anymore. It's marketer spring break. And so I understand from Southwise perspective where they're like, you know,
this is bad for business.
When the people at Coca-Cola really don't want to deal with the drama. Yeah. And I totally get that. Their reaction to just canceling both panels outright was not good. Then the blowback started. And
well, they couldn't just cancel Level Up.
No.
It looked even worse, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, we can argue whether or not the Save Point panel ever should have been approved or not, but they approved it. And once you approve it, I mean, you know, you make your bed, you've got to lie in it. So first they tried to get rid of both. Now they're doing this, you know, this summit on harassment, but by including people who have some of the people on other panels are saying are leading campaigns or involved with people who are part of the harassment, it makes it a difficult situation. So I don't know how.
Yeah, Alex says he's going to continue his boycott. Brianna says she's going to go because you got to have the discussion. But she's very brave.
She's very brave. And I said when all the stuff happened, you know, before she and I were even doing a podcast together, I made a comment when she started getting some of her death threats and other stuff. I said, you know, they picked the wrong person because she's not going to back down. Yeah. And she hasn't. And she's speaking at other panels that aren't even associated with this stuff because her career isn't just Gamergate. Her career isn't just harassment and gaming. You know, she's a game
developer. She'd like to get way beyond this, obviously.
I'm sure she would. And it sucks that she can't and that other people who are involved with this can't, that literally their entire identity is whether you're pro or against it has to be led up into this, let's face it, very small movement that is very, you know, politically charged, that has a lot of emotion on both sides, but is a very small thing in the big scheme of things. My big issue with South by Southwest, and I say this as someone who has gone, like I said, and been part of that community for years, is that you can't. This is not an issue where you can pretend as if you're going to be neutral and not take sides on, because they already took a side. You know, they approved the Save Point panel, and that's fine. But if you're going to do that, then you need to acknowledge that this is not a place where you can, you know, the people's safety does kind of come at issue, but also just, you know, you can't having a harassment summit in response to the criticism they were getting for not being, you know, I guess sensitive enough just seems short-sighted, especially when some of the people that were, you know, victims of some of the harassment immediately after the panels were pulled are saying, hey, you know, I'm now getting even more harassment because you're now doing this anti-harassment panel thing. I don't know. The whole thing is a mess. And I'm not really sure what the reaction is going to be, but it doesn't look like South By has handled this correctly in any way at all, which is ironic considering, you know, that the amount of panels that happen at South by Southwest every year explaining to people how to, you know, handle social media crises.
Yeah, they didn't handle it well.
No.
On Monday, they canceled the panels. By Friday, the pain point had become great enough that they created this day-long online harassment summit. I have to say, that seems like a good response. It is clearly something that needs to be talked about, and inviting all the members, I guess inviting controls to an event like that may not be
the best thing to do. It just depends on how good the folks are on the other side of actually having a debate.
Yes.
Because you know, the hard part with trolls is that they're just, not...
Right.
Well, but the thing is if...
They're chaotic.
But done well, they can pull the trolls out and make them look absolutely insane. You know, like a good person on the other side who knows what they're doing can tear these guys apart by letting them just talk.
Agreed. And I also I feel like it's a thing too where, you know, there are certain gatekeepers that kind of come up to this thing. You know, you've got to pay to attend this festival unless you're a speaker or you're press or something. And it's not a cheap event to attend. So yeah, I wonder if I believe that in the beginning they thought that in and of itself, the fact that there is, you know, a kind of a border to entry, you know, having to pay a lot of money would prevent a lot of, you know, harassers from showing up in person. And maybe it will, maybe it won't. But by streaming this online, which I think is important, and I think the debate and having everybody involved in the debate, no matter what side they're on, is important too. I don't think you can just have a conference with one side of this. I mean, if they're not going to choose sides, if they're really going to try to be neutral, then they need to be, you know, they need to set ground rules, though, that say, we're not going to in any way support that if we find out people associated with one panel, and I don't care what side you're on, but if you're on one panel and you're supporting behind the scenes harassment or doxing or, you know, just general, you know, like trying to make people's lives miserable, you can't be involved with this event. I think that should be one thing. And I don't know if some of the people on, you know, who are potentially involved with this feel like South By has their back because of the way they felt like they were treated when they brought up the fact that, hey, you know, it's kind of a problem that this panel was approved alongside our panel. And now we're getting, you know, it was already hard enough for one of the panels, which wasn't approved, to even get there because of the harassment. And South By didn't seem to take that seriously. I understand why anybody would kind of go into this skeptically. I mean, I'm a little skeptical that this thing will actually end up happening at all. I don't know.
It seems like, I mean, the Save Point panel was supposedly, I understand it's the nexus with Gamergate, but it was supposedly about ethics and game journalism, right?
Which is supposed to be what Gamergate's about. The whole point of that panel, I mean, it was kind of a brilliant troll on their part, if I'm being totally honest. It was kind of brilliant. They submitted a panel submission after panel submissions were no longer allowed, after voting was already half over. They were able to get it approved. And they even created their own organization. And then they loaded it with people who are on the pro-Gamergate side, and they never used Gamergate in the description. And you know what? I'm not going to criticize them for that. That was smart. They got through. That's fine.
But would they be talking about ethics in gaming journalism? Or would, I mean, what?
Oh, well, no, because to them, they're the same issue. So, I mean, I don't understand how you can have a conversation about ethics and gaming journalism if you're on that side and that's your perspective where you're not mentioning Gamergate. I don't understand how you could have that conversation without it even coming up.
But what's wrong with the Gamergate then? If it's just about ethics and journalism, that's not a problem.
Well, I mean, if that's what it's about, I don't
know. I understand that some people use that as a banner under which to organize a total harassment of people like Brianna and Anita Sarkeesian and others.
And Zoe Quinn. I mean, well, let's start up with...
But that's bad, but that may be a separate thing, right? Or is it?
Well, it could be a separate thing. No, because it's not. Because I don't believe it is. Because it started with their idea of ethics in gaming journalism was the fact that an ex-boyfriend of a game developer started talking about other people she was maybe not involved with, and then drawing conclusions and correlations that weren't even true, saying the whole reason she got her game reviewed on this website was because of this relationship with someone else.
Right.
That's what they're talking about when it comes to ethics in journalism. It's not ethics in journalism. It's slut shaming is what it is. That's okay. Honestly what it is.
Okay.
That and if they have broader ethical concerns with the gaming press, that's completely fine. But much of the conversation about it was never divided between like the conversation of someone's personal life and something else, you know, there. And if we want to have topics about conversations about ethics and journalism, that's a fair conversation to have. There's certainly ethical lines that every type of business journalism, including gaming, struggles with. And one of those is how close you become with your sources, how, you know, what do you go through? I mean, Tim and I know this, you know, when you know people as friends, but also, you know, they are potentially people you write about. You know, it can be a tough line to hoe, and that's an interesting discussion to have. I don't necessarily think that for all the banner they've been putting it under, it's the that's really what they care about. And I wouldn't be opposed to having or even seeing a discussion or a debate between both sides if it was moderated correctly and if it was there was respect on both sides. I think that some of the skepticism comes into place with just the fact that people who have been genuinely harassed, whether they're from people who are really part of the movement or not, whether it's people who are involved with these other panels or not, they feel like they've been genuinely harassed and targeted, and they don't necessarily like the idea that people who have been targeting and harassing them could now be part of this same anti-harassment summit. Right. And I think that the only way you solve this is by being transparent, which South by Southwest hasn't been.
It sounds like they mismanaged it from the beginning, even to the point of allowing a panel proposed after the deadline and so forth. I think they were obviously trying to be fair, and what ended up happening is they just made a hash of it. Right?
Yeah.
That seemed fair? So how was the Tokyo Auto Show?
It was great.
Did you have fun?
It was controversy-free, I'm very happy to say.
Yeah, thank goodness. You know what I'm really interested in? Of course, we've seen gas-powered vehicles, diesel-powered vehicles. We've seen hybrids. We've seen electric vehicles. But Honda has a new fuel cell vehicle, and I think they showed it there, right? Did you see it?
I got to drive it, as a matter of fact, yes. So Honda's actually made a prototype fuel cell car since, I think, 2008. They had this car called the FCX Clarity, which was available in very limited numbers, basically just for testing people in standards bodies and that kind of thing. But they're actually going to make a production version of the car and have it available for sale in Japan starting in March of this spring, called the Clarity Fuel Cell is the formal name of the car. But it's basically a normal four-door sedan. It's kind of got some funky styling, so maybe not all that normal. But ultimately, instead of running on gas or plugging it in the wall, you charge it up with hydrogen. There are two fuel tanks. You can see in that picture there, there's a big fuel tank in the trunk, a smaller one underneath the rear seats. And it gets you about 400 miles of range, which is pretty impressive. You can recharge it in less than 2 minutes because it's, again, you're just pumping in gas in the thing effectively. And the only emissions from this car is water. And it's drinkable distilled water effectively that comes out of the tailpipe in the thing. It drives very nicely, very quiet. Just like driving an EV. Instead of having the electrons coming from a battery, they come from the hydrogen.
So it's high torque because it's an electric motor. It's just a different way of powering an electric motor.
It's great. They haven't given us a price yet, which is the big question. I'm guessing it's going to be fairly expensive because this is all a lot of exciting new technology. But
you don't have the batteries. You don't have a big battery expense and the big weight of batteries, right? So that seems like it would be an improvement.
There's a small battery pack underneath the front seats, but basically that just serves kind of as a buffer for the fuel cell. The electricity comes from the hydrogen through the fuel cell into the battery and then out to the motors, so that way you can kind of store up some electricity. But it does make the cost a lot lower. And, you know, it solves a lot of the issues that people have with EVs, with range, and ultimately it kind of, in theory, could give gas stations a way forward, too, into the future without them having to disappear. But, of course, the big problem is availability. There are, maybe a few dozen hydrogen stations in the U.S. that you could drive your car up to and fill up, and you're going to need a lot more than that before this can go forward. But Honda actually had a solution for that, too. They have a thing, basically a fuel cell generator. It's about the size of a shipping crate, a little bit bigger. But basically, you can plunk that down anywhere, uses solar power and a source of water to generate hydrogen, which is kind of neat. So in theory, you know, there's an easy solution forward for the hydrogen generation, too.
I just want
to. But we'll see if that ever takes off.
In any motor vehicle, what you need is a source of a lot of energy that can be easily stored and then released on demand. Yeah. You'd like that a source of energy to be renewable. The problem with fossil fuels is there are no more dinosaurs. So you want it to be solar would be nice, but there's other ways to do this. And if you can then somehow take the solar energy, convert it to this compact reusable form of energy, then you've got something. How highly compressed is the hydrogen in this stuff?
I forgot how many PSI it is. It's pretty high. I don't remember the number offhand.
So that's a potential.
It's not like a scuba tank high, but it is quite high. Those are carbon fiber fuel tanks. So it's definitely, you know, they're crash rated and all that good stuff. So they are really, but certainly that is a concern.
Any storage that stores enough energy to move a car, several ton car, 400 miles, has a lot of risk. I mean, gasoline is far from a risk-free fuel. So I think that, you know, obviously you want to moderate that risk as best you can, but everything has risk.
And batteries have their risk, too. We've certainly seen battery compartments in EVs get ruptured by debris. We saw Tesla catch fire because the battery compartment was ruptured.
So you don't think that these hydrogen fuel cells are any more risky than some other solution out there?
I don't think so, no. I mean, ultimately, you know, we've got to get more on the road and see how things go. But they've certainly been very thoroughly crash tested. And there are systems in the car that will, for example, if they detect a leak or a problem in the system, they'll shut down all the electrical systems in the car to reduce the chance of a spark or anything like that. So, you know, they're being pretty smart about it. But you know, based on the I saw those tanks, they look pretty beefy. And I've seen crash footage where even if that car gets rear-ended in a very serious accident, the tanks don't rupture. So right. I'm pretty confident.
A gas tank ruptures, you got a problem.
Yep.
Witness the Pinto.
I mean, do you think that given the fact that, you know, EVs are starting to really take, I mean, electric cars and plug-in and everything else is really taking off in the U.S., do you think hydrogen has any chance at all?
It's hard to say. The big thing about hydrogen and the nice thing about this is that any development that goes into EVs, making more efficient motors, making more efficient batteries, that also helps the hydrogen market as well, because these are effectively just EVs, but instead of having a big battery pack, they have a small battery pack plus a hydrogen tank and a fuel cell. So those two developments can go very much in parallel. Ultimately, I don't think you're going to get to a point where you can have really fast charging and have those stations everywhere, even through all of the very rural areas of the U.S. for, you know, decades and decades to come. Hydrogen is, in theory, a much easier solution in that regard, in that you can make a hydrogen-powered car. You could, in theory, make a hydrogen-powered car that you could plug in if you wanted to and charge it for short range, then top up the tank if you want to go for large range. And again, it would be a relatively trivial thing to convert a gas station into a hydrogen station if you wanted to. It's just a question of someone making the investment to do so. So, you know, it could be a stopgap measure, but I do think it has an opportunity.
I mean, it seems like a difference between, like, VHS and Betamax, where it's Betamax. You know, like, I mean, the thing is that it doesn't matter whether it's a better solution or not. It's that, like, I just know personally, my next car will be, you know, an electric car. I just know that I just want to be able to plug it in. I don't want to think about any more liquid.
Yeah, people
don't
have hydrogen fuel cell generators in their home. So it's,
no, I just want to.
But you don't have a gas station in your home either.
I also think that
there is a convenience to be able to plug into the wall when you get in the garage.
And I think in the grander scheme of things, when we think about the environment and everything else, I think what we really need is all the cars to move to electricity, because then as we change the central way of generating electricity, you know, to a more, you know, environment friendly, we don't have to keep on changing all the little things. You know, the big thing that keeps us stuck with burning gas is all those stupid gas stations.
Right.
And so the thing is that if we, you know, if you move to something that's centralized, then it's just easier to change the center.
Tim's point is, this is an electric car. It's just that you...
It is. Right. It's except that we still have to have little, like, we're filling it up with, like...
You would do that with electricity. How efficient is the conversion to hydrogen, water to hydrogen? Is it an efficient... means of creating electricity or no?
Effectively, 1 kilogram of hydrogen is very similar to 1 gallon of gasoline, actually. So they're actually very, very
making
close.
Making that hydrogen is not super costly energy-wise?
I mean, that is a somewhat difficult thing to do. It depends on what you're starting with. If you're talking about pure electricity and purely water, I don't know what the exact efficiency is, but it's pretty low. But then again, you know, if we get to a point where indeed we do have free or cheap electricity, then it doesn't really matter at that point. You can make them with hydrogen as you want to. And you could even, in theory, do that at home if you want to. You know, it's not that difficult to make hydrogen from solar power and from water. So, you know, again, I see this as something that can very much go along in parallel. Having hydrogen development going on doesn't really detract from having EV development going on. It may mean that we have extra stations going on, but I'll tell you, there's no way that pure battery EVs are going to make sense in upstate New York within the next 15 or 20 years.
Exactly.
Certainly not.
Cold weather and batteries are not
going to be enough charging. Yeah.
But I just don't know.
People need to drive a long way.
Yeah. But I just don't know. I mean, from Western Pennsylvania, I don't see anyone buying. They wouldn't have the same range problem, but they wouldn't buy a hydrogen car. I mean, like they just, you know, they might not buy an
EV
either.
Cars in
no,
general?
But I'm just saying that in those sparse areas, I'm not sure how popular any of the newer technologies would be.
You have the same problem with EVs in cold weather and in sparsely populated areas. It's not ideal. It's interesting. How was it to drive? Did you like to drive it?
It was quite nice. It was interesting that you can actually hear the fuel cells emitting gas. So it kind of makes like a hissing noise, which is very interesting. You don't usually hear that in EVs, but otherwise it's very much like an EV, very quiet. You only hear the whir of the transmission from the engine. Very good power, very quiet, very smooth, quite nice. It wasn't a very long drive, I'll admit, but it felt very much like any other Honda from the inside. You really wouldn't know the difference if you didn't look in the trunk, and then the trunk is somewhat compromised, which is a bit of a shame. But that's really the only drawback that I saw.
Well, they're putting them on sale next year.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. There you have it. Any autonomous vehicles at the Tokyo Auto Show?
We did see a few. In fact, my colleague Chris Paukert was in a Nissan that almost swerved into an 18-wheeler on the highway in Tokyo, which was a bit of an unfortunate demonstration for the technology. It's definitely something that Honda was
like
showing
off. Did he scream like a
girl? Of course he did.
I would have. Sure with all due respect, Christina, when I scream like a girl, it's scary. I'm sure you don't, but I'm just saying.
Oh no! I can scream like a girl. No.
I realize that's a pretty sexist thing to say.
But it's funny.
Especially after all, like, talk. You're getting yourself in trouble, Italy.
I know. I am a troll. Let's see.
Stereotypes are funny because they hurt people.
They hurt, and of course, all comedy hurts somebody. If it's not me, it's you, and I'd prefer it hurt you. I'm just saying. HP, as of today, is two companies. HP Inc. will sell PCs and printers. HPE, HP Enterprise, will do all the servers and the enterprise stuff. But they solved the problem of who gets the garage.
Oh, did they?
David Hewlett and Packard's office has been preserved since they passed away 25 years ago. The garage where pretty. HP was founded 75 years ago apparently has been moved lock, stock, and barrel next to the office. And then they're going to split it off and make a hallway from both companies because they're still in the same building.
Oh, my God.
And both companies.
Sure. Oh, my God.
I can't imagine there's a lot of traffic to the old office.
I can't either. It's honestly cool looking. I can't imagine either. I mean, I think if you're at HP, you're like, do I really want to like walk through this hallway that reminds me?
Only if Meg Whitman is watching. Only if Meg Whitman.
Only then, and then you're like, oh my God, this used to be amazing. This is the company that helped build Silicon Valley. This and Fairchild, and now.
And now what?
And now.
Sounds like a weekend visitation
now
kind of thing.
It's Carly Farina's resume builder.
Oh my God. it only took a decade after she was fired for the mess that
how
she made.
How quickly we've forgotten. Yeah, how quickly we've forgotten.
It took 10 years after she was fired, so 15 years after the Compaq merger was complete, that mess is finally now completely over, and the result is two companies. Although, in fairness to Carly, she was not the worst CEO.
No. No, I think Leo Apotheker gets the nod there, yeah.
Of course he does, because he spent $10 billion on Magic Beans.
Yes.
Autonomy.
Yes. Nice job, Leo.
He spent $10 billion on Magic Beans, and that is why.
Magic Beans. They could have worked, you know.
Okay, what was the name of it? Was it an overture?
Autonomy.
Oh, Autonomy, that's right. Yeah.
Autonomy, and literally $10 billion, and he had to write off the whole thing because it didn't work.
These things happen. Develop software to enable the automated personalization and categorization of text sources, if it worked.
Right.
But even the description sounds like...
even that doesn't sound good.
The description is like every buzzword you could come up with, and then somebody...
$10 billion?
$10 billion. Wow. He was like, let's get rid of WebOS. Let's not go into mobile, because that's certainly not the future.
He also wanted to shut down the PC business, which might have been a good idea.
He shut down the whole thing. I'm saying he wanted to get rid of the whole thing. He wanted to split it apart. He was like, look... PCs, no. Servers, meh. Mobile, certainly not the future. But this autonomy company. I got a tip from a guy who told me it's going to be the next big thing.
Lord.
I'm telling you guys, it's going to be so.
And then you got Mark Hurd. Actually, there've been quite a few. It's been a long series of kind of.
No, Mark Hurd was fine. I mean, look, he was apparently not very great to work for. Like, apparently they had a thing where there's a Fortune article that went into details about how. If you were in the office after a certain period of time at night, all the lights went off so they could save electricity.
That's dark.
So people brought in their own lamps so they could continue working longer, and then they get in trouble for bringing in their own lamps.
Lord.
So, I mean, look, this is a company that has just not had good stuff. But then his end came, you know, there was
the texting, the pretexting investigation.
Yeah, the scandal was involved with that. And then he went on to, now he's co-CEO of Oracle, so he's fine.
Yeah, Larry Ellison loved the guy.
Larry Ellison like was on TV like yelling at HP like, what are you doing?
Fools.
Like the last time, and Larry Ellison doesn't do that very often. Like he yelled at the Apple people for getting rid of Steve Jobs, and then yelled at you know when they were, of course you should bring him back. He's the best thing ever. And then he did the same thing when HP got rid of Hurd. But no, I mean that company, my God, somebody really needs to just do a soap opera, like a nighttime soap called The Corporation.
Oh, it'd be good. I'd watch that.
Right? Wouldn't that be good?
Yeah.
And it would just literally be everything from HP.
Both companies...
Mad Men, but way more boring.
Yeah, well, Each of the companies worth $50 billion. So they're not small companies. They'd both be in the Fortune 500.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, the Senate voted. I actually thought they had voted to pass this last week, and I apologize for misstating that. They had voted it out of committee. Then on Tuesday, they passed CISA, the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act. It is now passed.
That doesn't actually protect your cybersecurity at all.
Yeah, and really, in you know, makes it hard for you to stay private. It's going to go to the, I guess they'll have to reconcile the House and the Senate bills, and then it goes to the president, who's already said he will pass it. The privacy flaws have not been fixed. I think more than one, company in Silicon Valley secretly, in public said, oh, this CISA bill is a terrible bill, secretly in private said, hey, can you pass that bill? Which is alleged Facebook did. Because it let the companies off the hook. They are no longer liable for giving government information about us. We can't sue them. We can't do anything about it. It just lets them off the hook. And I think that's, you know, if I'm the guy running Google or Facebook or Microsoft or Apple, I would say, hey, that's good. I like that. I don't want to be sued. So I suspect there was kind of secret support for this in Silicon Valley. Well, it remains to be seen if we're any less protected than we were. I feel like at this point.
Well, I mean, I think that's the irony is that they were all kind of debating this cyber information security bill that's not going to protect our security, that's going to let companies off the hook when they get hacked and let them off the hook when they share our information. And we're all like, well, knowing what they can already do, are we that much worse off? Like, how jaded have we become?
The Department of Homeland Security in July wrote a letter saying the bill could flood the agency with information of dubious value at the same time as it sweeps away privacy protections. That's a bill I can get behind.
Right.
Only in America.
Only in America.
And Russia.
I should end on an up note. Samsung says mobile's on the mend. That's not it.
Nice try.
Good news. The EFF has pointed out that the Librarian of Congress has finally done the right thing with regard to, and I bet you have something to say about this, Tim, reverse engineering software in vehicles. This was illegal because of digital rights management. This rulemaking process happens every 3 years. The Librarian of Congress gets to kind of make rules about how the DMCA is enforced. So the librarian recognized the need for vehicle owners to circumvent access restrictions in order to repair, modify, and tinker with the software of their car.
Right. There's been a lot of discussion about this, of course, with all the various hacks that have come out over the past 6 months or so. And that problem is only going to get worse, of course, going forward. So there's been a pretty strong case made that ultimately these systems would be more secure. People were able to see better into the systems. And ultimately, you know, I think there's a lot of pros and cons to that argument. Definitely the automotive industry is definitely taking the stance that a lot of operating system makers and others have taken in the past, that ultimately everything should be locked down because things will be more secure that way. I think we've seen a lot of steps forward in the mobile industry and elsewhere. As things get more open, things do get more secure. And I think that there is an opportunity for that in the automotive side. It's going to take a long time to get, the traditional automakers on that front, but this at least does give people a back door to be able to go in and look for these exploits and you know, hopefully do good things with them, report them through the correct channels and make sure they get fixed. But if anything, it'll definitely help to keep everybody on their toes it'll make me feel a bit better about the situation.
You think we would have known about the VW emissions hack sooner had this rule been in place?
That's a good question, because that was almost an official inquiry in the way it was reported through the EPA. You know, I don't think that necessarily would have fallen underneath this, but certainly things like the Jeep hack and the OnStar hacks we've seen over the past 6 months, those are certainly things that would not have been legal underneath if this rule had been changed. So, you know, making these things legal, giving, you know, ultimately whether or not these are legal is not going to stop the people who want to do bad things. I think that's the most important thing. If this is illegal, if you're trying to hack into someone's car to do something nefarious, you're already breaking the law. It doesn't matter. But if it is against the law for a researcher to look for problems, then that will stop some white hat hackers from doing the right thing. Yep. And ultimately, I think that would have been a problem.
Librarian said extended the law, the rule that you can jailbreak your smartphone, put your own firmware on there. And that exemption is now covering all portable, all-purpose mobile computing devices, including tablets and watches. Hack away.
Yay.
It's okay to root and jailbreak to your heart's content.
And unlock, right?
And unlock.
That's a big
No. I think you can jailbreak. I think you can root. But I think unlocking is another story. I'm not sure. That's a good question.
Oh, my
God. I think
God.
It's in FCC territory, doesn't
it? Yeah, I think so.
Probably does.
I think so. And the FCC has made rules that promote unlocking.
They have, but yet they'll still try to force
I don't think
you.
I don't think the librarian gets to overrule that. The librarian. I want that title.
But
sounds like a title from like a
TV show.
Yeah,
what if my unlock takes place by rooting my phone?
Halo 6, the Arbiter and the
librarian. Mm-hmm. or maybe it's a kind of a mutant, you know? Maybe Michael Fassbender is the librarian. librarian also granted the EFF's proposal to preserve abandoned video games. You can now modify your copy of a game to eliminate the need for authentication server. Take the piracy stuff out if the server's been shut down. Well, duh. Museums, libraries, and archives can jailbreak game consoles as needed to get the games working again.
That's awesome.
Yep.
That is awesome.
I just want to know when we can put MAME on our Apple TV.
Yeah, this doesn't quite make MAME possible.
I'm just saying, Asteroids.
But it could make MAME possible if you own, like, you know, the cabinet files, if you have the actual ROMs themselves.
And the server, devices. The authentication, it used this authentication server, and the server has been shut down. Mm-hmm. Then it's okay. Mm-hmm.
So it had to be a modern game.
I think so.
Those are no fun.
Yeah.
It's got to be the old
game. They're not any funny. Although, I mean, some of those games aren't we already at, like, the point where at least some of the hardware stuff has, like, the. It's like public domain now or whatever.
Well, plenty of EA games have had their servers shut down. So there's certainly plenty of those on the market that would be eligible for this.
Trade them on the free market.
I know, I'm just saying.
I think that's going a little far.
That's all I want. Like, all I read in that paragraph was, when will MAME be on my Apple TV?
You know, it's like that. It doesn't overrule copyright law.
But here's the good news, because, it doesn't overrule copyright law. But let's say in the privacy of your own home, if someone were to write a MAME, you know, emulator for the Apple TV, which of course they have, which now means we could just jailbreak our Apple TVs and, you know, in the privacy of our own homes, break copyright.
You know, I would
law.
Jailbreak an Apple TV just to have, I would have a whole other Apple TV as another input.
Oh, totally.
Just to put MAME on it.
I still have an
so
old
So my kids
Xbox.
Can play Pitfall.
I still have the original Xbox, like the original Xbox, the gigantic one. And it was the 1.0 version. And that was the one that was really super easy to, like, I remember opening it up and using a soldering gun to solder 2 points so that I could install what was then XP.
That chip. Yeah.
Yes. I didn't even have to do a chip. I just literally had to solder 2 points. And I had, like, a bigger hard drive in it. And I had MAME. Yeah. And I had, like, every single old console game ever. And I still have that thing. Because that's still, like, the best, like, old console. Like, that's still my favorite thing ever. Oh,
my hacked Xbox, I think we gave it to one of Henry's friends. It had every game on it.
Yeah, it's so good.
So awesome. And those games, I've lost the CDs or the cartridges or whatever it was we used in those days. I've lost those long ago. The games are still on the hard drive.
I just want to go back to being 12 years old, get Men at Work playing on the Sonos, and play Pitfall. See, that would be for me.
Atari made a retro console or whatever Atari.
It was just a controller.
Well, no, it wasn't just the controllers, but it was a smaller box. But they actually had it so that you at least with the it was like the rerun or something like that. The second generation one had Pitfall. It had the Activision titles.
Oh, did it?
And it actually had it did. And then it actually was like a hardware level emulator. It wasn't software. So there was actually a way you could like ship it to actually use the old original cartridges with it if you wanted to.
Oh,
I may or may not have bought that version off of Amazon specifically for that purpose.
It'd be so much fun.
So is hacking screensavers legal just to bring the show?
No. However, you can remix videos from DVD and Blu-ray sources to create, as long as it's fair use, create your own.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wait, that's actually...
Remix. Okay, so I'll read it to you.
Yeah, you can read this one.
The librarian effectively renewed the existing exemption for non-commercial remix videos and expanded it to cover circumvention of DRM on Blu-ray discs.
Nice.
All right, go librarian. We should all buy this librarian some coffee.
I know. Really I love should. This librarian.
I think I'd go for the whiskey.
They, you know, you could. There was a fair use exemption, but you had to use the analog hole, so you'd have a low copy
And then there was a DVD John's thing was eventually approved for the DVD stuff, but they haven't ever had it for Blu-ray.
Keys Blu-ray. So now you can have a high quality source to create persuasive, compelling works, remixes, and else otherwise.
My stuff's not very compelling, so it's probably illegal.
A victory for the EFF, and thank you to the Librarian of Congress, or just seriously, as we know him, the Librarian.
We need to like send him some cookies or something.
Yeah. I think his term is coming up.
I don't think we're allowed to. Sure it is. Not even cookies, I don't think.
Really?
No.
Not even from Levain's, because that would be great. I would totally do that. I would totally like chip in for that.
His name is David S. Mao. He became acting Library of Congress on October 1st, upon the retirement of James H. Billington. But acting doesn't sound like it's too permanent.
He just came in, did the damage.
He was the deputy librarian.
Signed off the paperwork. He was like, the other dude retired.
Yeah. What we were gonna okay, do. Finally. Could do what I want.
Check.
I'm an X-Man. I'm the librarian.
We gotta let you jailbreak your Apple TV.
So I guess it's a presidential appointment, and I don't know if he'll get an appointment or not, but he's the acting.
It's probably going to all turn out to be Mystique anyway.
The acting librarian.
It will all turn out to be Mystique, always.
I like that.
He just came in for a second.
Alex Lindsay is at the Pixel Core. You can follow him on Twitter, AlexLindsay, and that's a good way to keep up on his efforts. I should have brought it in for you. I got the Ricoh Theta S 3D camera.
The new one?
Yeah, I've been playing.
Oh, I love
I'm waiting for mine to show up. Oh, I have two of the other ones.
So fun.
They are great.
I've posted some stills and videos on the Ricoh 360 site.
It's even better when you get your phone hooked up to it, so you can put it on a little tripod, so you're not always standing there holding on.
Yeah, because otherwise you see a lot of your hand and
a lot of
your
you
face.
Kind of you got to decide. Like I've decided, I kind of like the side. I'm not really looking at you. Look.
Yeah.
When I'm taking stuff, but
yeah. See, I did one of the studio. So let me take you to the Theta 360 site. You can see my oeuvre. This one I did with the as you recommended. I did this with the phone as a remote. Oh, no, there's my hand.
Yeah.
there I am looking at it, but that's our street outside. I've done some other ones.
You can get a little suction cup and put it on the front of your car. Now you can go 25 minutes with the new one.
Yeah, 25 minutes of nonstop.
It's just like you're sitting on a car.
I recorded the first 15 minutes of the radio show doing that. That's kind of fun. Well, for me. There's a lot of them of me.
But it looks and it works in
look at the quality.
Yeah.
You can
the new one is this 4K? Is the new one 4K?
No, it's HD, but if you zoom in, I mean it's good enough quality you can read. No,
but I think that's 4K. The images are. I think the video is.
Oh, the video is less good. The stitching is. Do we need a live real-time stitcher because it has live HDMI out? How do we get that working?
Does it have a live HDMI?
Yeah. Out? But you have to stitch it in real time. All we were getting is two big circles.
Oh, I can do that.
Can you stitch in real time?
Mm-hmm. So, I can stitch six GoPros in real time.
Really? Mm-hmm. What's the software?
Wow. Video Stitch.
Okay. So if we fed it a live image.
Well, you'd have to figure out the transformations. But I don't know whether Video Stitch would do it, but we could figure it out.
Yeah, see, that's what's weird about this.
As soon as I get mine,
two spheres.
I know. It's so awesome.
Well, let me know because I would love to do
a rabbit hole here.
I would. Yeah, this is a real rabbit hole. I would love to do a video of the show while we're doing it. You could look around and.
Yep.
Tim Stevens, thank you for being here. We appreciate it. From CNET, he is automotive editor at large, gets to do whatever he wants, Tim_Stevens. Soon the ice will have frozen,
mm-hmm.
and he will be racing. It's always good to have you.
I will be racing, doing lots of other good stuff, too.
Good. Anything you want to plug?
I would love to, but I can't plug
secret.
What I'm working on just yet. It's secret for another little while. But stay tuned, and you'll see soon.
You're going to launch a podcast network, too, just like everybody else?
No. Okay. No.
What mic are you using?
What is that mic? You sound rich and deep and good.
This is a Blue, a Yeti.
Ah, Yeti. We like the Yeti.
Yeti.
Mm-hmm.
We also appreciate your time, Ms. Warren, film girl, Christina Warren from Mashable.
Thank you.
Doing great stuff as always at Mashable. Anything new you want to plug?
Well, my Apple TV review, which went up last week, so that was good. And I didn't write this, but Lance Ulanoff wrote a really amazing article where he met Phil Schiller at Apple and did like a great profile. And
yes, so yes, should, yeah.
People should read that. It was really, really well
he
done.
He also did a great behind the scenes with Panos Panay about the new
he
Surface
did.
Book.
Surface I really, book. Yeah, no, Lance is killing that stuff.
Yeah.
So rather than plug myself, I would rather plug Lance's great work because it's seriously awesome.
Thank you, everybody. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. Now, we have gone to Standard Time, finally catching up with the rest of the world, which did it a couple of weeks ago. So that means we are now airing at 2300 UTC. So if you, you know, just so you know, we're like almost midnight, 2300 UTC.
Is that where I almost missed my flight in Turkey?
Yeah.
Because I was looking at my iPhone.
They change
and I'm like,
taking,
we know. I'm like taking my time and I'm looking at my iPhone mm-hmm. and it says, oh, it's 12:01, you know, and I look up to see when my flight's going to leave. And
they already fell back.
And it was like 1:15 and I had to run.
Time zones.
I caught it.
Such a mess.
Turkish.
Such a mess.
We have a t-shirt.
Let's not forget teespring.com/twit. Just 9 days left to get, I think, the prettiest t-shirt we've done. Anthony Nielsen designed this one. It's really
That's
great.
That's pretty.
It's, as with all our t-shirts, a limited edition. We only do a certain number of them, and once they're done, they're done.
Eight.
So if you want to get it.
There's only eight of them.
There's only eight. No, there's more than eight. There's as many as people want, and they're only $20. They're not expensive. So, yeah, TEESPRING, teespring.com/twit. If you're not here in person, oh, I didn't do any of the promos or anything, did I?
That's all right. We only have the what's on Twit.
We can, you know what I'll do? We'll put it earlier in the show. So if you're watching this show after the fact on demand, yeah, you already saw it. So we did do the promos.
It was amazing.
It was so good.
So good.
What was I thinking?
It was one of the best ones, I
earlier,
think.
Earlier, we... Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.